Do it.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The Lyric Slate
Tech Show.
The Lyric Slate
Tech Show.
The Lyric Slate
Tech Show.
Let's get down to business.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open technology, and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
I was getting a little excited that I didn't screw up the beginning, but...
You did it again.
You know what?
Yeah. What exactly is the issue there? What are you using to?
Rhythmbox. And you know what? Rhythmbox has a playlist, and every time I add or remove a file to
the mic,
every time I add or remove a file from the playlist, it screws the playlist up. Even though it looks right, it's like it plays it all out of order. So I'm going to have to manually go in there and create the playlist, edit the playlist file itself.
What if you, like, rename the files with 01, 02, 03?
Maybe I should just use Beat Media Player, because that works flawlessly all the time.
Why don't you use XMMS?
Because XMMS is old, and Beat Media Player
hasn't been touched in ages.
Has replaced it.
And, but it works.
Yeah, well, so does Beat Media Player. Shut up, Alan. We have a great guest. They didn't want to hear about Beat Media Player. I want to hear our wonderful guest today. Pat, introduce our wonderful guest.
We've got an awesome guest. We've got Bradley Kuhn from the Software Freedom Law Center. Bradley, we heard your keynote at the Ohio Linux Fest, and you gave an awesome speech.
I appreciate it. I'm glad people enjoyed it. It's available online on our website for those listeners that haven't heard it before. If they go to softwarefreedom.org to the events page, there's a copy of it there if people want to hear what it was like.
I guess, could you just start with just a little background on yourself and your history?
Actually, one of the things I wanted to mention before we got started, that I did listen to some of your old shows, and I listened to the interview you guys did with Bill Hurd of Commodore, and that was just really excellent. I wanted to compliment you guys on that. I really enjoyed that. It was great to hear and hear sort of, you know, stories from how all that got started. And I'm sure I can't do his interview justice, but I'll try to give you my best spiel of my backstory of how I got into open source and free software. In the mid 1990s, I started volunteering for Richard Stallman, doing various different things. And one of the things I've learned in FOSS is the way to become somebody in the FOSS world is to be the volunteer that shows up and is willing to work on whatever somebody asks you to work on. You know, there's a million volunteers out there who are like, I want to work on this specific technical problem, but they aren't willing to do the mundane, boring work that needs to get done to keep a FOSS project going. But I was always the type of volunteer that showed up and said, well, what needs doing most? And that got me somewhat noticed by RMS. And in the beginning of 2000, he hired me to work part-time at first, basically as his assistant is how I started. And I mostly helped him answer his email spool. You know, it's interesting thing about RMS is that he still answers all of his own email personally, although his assistant tries to sort of organize it for him a little better, although sometimes that wasn't always possible because he got to it before even I could. I did that for a while, and I started doing help with licensing issues and GPL enforcement, and I got really into the licensing side of FOSS, and that was a lot of fun. RMS decided to hire me full-time. And when I told him, I said, well, I don't want to just be full-time and be called, you know, you're just your assistant. because you know I was at that point I was you know doing GPL enforcement. I was talking to violators of the GPL, and they weren't that impressed when somebody said with their .sig file saying, assistant to Richard Stallman. So he said, well, why don't we just make you the vice president? So I think I'm the only person in a nonprofit's history to get promoted directly from assistant to the president to vice president. Which, if your listeners are familiar with the TV series The Office, both in the U.S. and in the U.K., there's that joke about being assistant president and assistant to the president. I actually jumped those two immediately when I was at FSF, so that was kind of fun. So after I was at FSF for about 5 years in that position, which actually eventually became executive director of FSF. I sort of reorganized the place. It was actually kind of dormant for most of the 1990s. You know, through the late 80s and into the early 90s, most of what FSF did was employ people, you know, to do programming work instead of other types of things. And as that was needed less and less, I think that it came to be that it wasn't really clear what FSF should do next. And as the licensing issues and education about licensing became more important, that's sort of what I developed FSF into, and I actually started hiring people there. It wasn't a lot of people working there when I got there, and we built a staff and got going and launched the membership program and so forth. So that's sort of my history at FSF. In late 2004, Eben Moglen, who was at the time on the board of directors of the Free Software Foundation, he's since left the board, got some funding to do specifically legal services for open source and free software projects. And that original funding came from an organization called OSDL, and now it's funded primarily by various different industry partners who are concerned about the legal status of open source and free software. That was a really interesting moment in the history of FOSS because it was right as the showcase was really starting to get strong and people were really afraid and there was a real need people felt for getting the legal certainty of open source and free software correct. And that's what SFLC, the Software Freedom Law Center, was formed to do. And I came, decided to come with Eben in part because my wife wanted to move to New York City and that's where SFLC was going to be based, to work for Eben Moglen doing this this thing at the SFLC. So I'll tell you briefly about what SFLC does. We are a legal services organization. We provide our services pro bono, at no charge, to open source and free software projects. Pretty much any project that's operated in a not-for-profit fashion that's under a FOSS license qualifies for our legal services. And we try to prioritize by projects that have the most need and projects that are, you know, key projects in the FOSS world. And we help them do everything from GPL enforcement to the more mundane things of corporate governance and making sure that they have their nonprofit status in place and various other things like that so they can get donations. And we help them with their licensing issues, help them with their copyrights, trademarks. If there's a patent question that comes up, we help them with that. We even help them deal with patents that are threatening free and open source software, which is something we're starting to do a little bit more of. So that's sort of that organization. I'm also involved with a closely related but separate organization called the Software Freedom Conservancy, which I actually serve as the president of. And that's an organization we spun out of SFLC to be a nonprofit corporate governance and status for smaller projects that weren't big enough to incorporate themselves, or they just didn't have the time it takes to put a board of directors together and do all the sort of somewhat non-hackerish, whereas there's very non-hackerish work you have to do to run a nonprofit. So what the Conservancy does is projects join it, and it has its own board of directors that manage the corporate governance aspects of running the nonprofit, and then those projects then qualify for 501c3 donations in the United States, which are often tax deductible for the contributor, and they're able to fund various activities like going to conferences or getting their developers memberships in development groups or whatever the developers need to continue to do their work. So that's another aspect of what SFLC does, because SFLC is donating my time to the Conservancy. The time I spend on that and my colleagues spend on Conservancy is donated by the SFLC. So that's sort of the whole story of how I got started and how I came into this and where I'm at now. So what else can I tell you guys?
Before we get into the...
Wait.
Can I just...
No, you can't, because this is relevant. fight.
Yeah. What is your actual... Did you say what your background is in? Like, do you have a degree?
Oh, I didn't go back far enough. Yes, I do have a degree. I have a couple of them. I got my bachelor's degree in computer science, and then I worked for a couple of years doing system administration work and some software development contracts, but mostly I've always been more of a sysadmin, system integrator type. And I just hated the corporate world so much. I hated the way that proprietary software worked. I was mostly supporting Sun Systems, Solaris, Sonos and Solaris, and I just hated, you know, not being able to get bugs fixed, and I got really into FOSS. I was already into FOSS as an undergraduate. I was an undergraduate from 1991 to 95. I'd already gotten into Emacs and various different free and open source software things. And once I got into the corporate software world and realized how horrible it was, I just couldn't take it. So I sort of became a refugee and hid out in graduate school for a while, and I went to graduate school in Cincinnati at the University of Cincinnati. Eventually they kicked me out of there, and I got the consolation prize for those who don't finish a PhD, which is a master's degree. And then I left there actually to go work for Stallman. In fact, most of my time in graduate school, I hope none of my people from my grad school listen to this, I spent most of my time in grad school not doing my thesis and doing volunteer work for FSF. So right when Stallman decided that he could hire me full time, I went to my advisor and said, how quickly can I finish my thesis? And it was one semester left, so I stayed one more semester to finish my thesis and then went to work for RMS. Because I know if I went and got the job at FSF, I'd never finish any degree beyond my bachelor's, so I figured I should at least finish that, and I think that's probably correct. If I had gone to FSF without defending my master's thesis, that is, I surely would have never gotten a degree.
Before we get too really into the really massive discussion, you know, the really intricate talk about, you know, lawsuits and, you know, defense and everything, I want to know is, what does RMS drink in the morning? Does he drink coffee or tea?
You know, I assume he's still the same. You know, I don't see RMS as much as I used to, since I don't work for him anymore. But he was always a tea drinker, generally. But the morning for him is usually like noon, so I don't know if he drinks anything in the morning. Of course, at 3 in the morning, he'll drink tea just as well, so I'm sure it's he likes green tea, I believe. But it's funny. It's actually an ironic thing. RMS, I worked for him for 5 years, and when I came over to SFLC, my relationship with him changed because he was the representative of a client organization. So one of the clients of the Software Freedom Law Center as a legal services organization is the organization I used to work for, the FSF. It's interesting. RMS and I get along so much better now that I don't work for him anymore. But I actually saw him a lot more during the GPLB3 process. Because when I was at FSF, he was always traveling and never actually in the offices at the FSF. And when he and Evan Moglen started to sit down to do more drafting on GPLB3, he was here in our SFLC offices a whole lot. So I used to see him a lot more during that 2005-2006 period than I did the entire time I worked for him. In fact, there's a funny story I can tell later about when I was working for RMS, about seeing him in person. But we'll get to that later.
I guess the real question that's on my mind is the status of the lawsuit that you guys filed against Monsoon Media on behalf of the BusyBox developers.
Yeah, so this is where you realize I'm not such a great interview. There's a couple of things I want to say. First of all, I'm the non-lawyer here. I'm the guy out there connecting us up with the hacker community. So I'm sort of like the halfway point between the lawyers and the hackers. So because I work for a legal services organization, I always have to remind people I am not a lawyer. I've also been taught by my lawyer colleagues that you don't comment on pending litigation. So I really can't comment yet on what's going about that. I can talk generally as much as you'd like about the general strategy for enforcing the GPL and how that works. If you want to talk about that, that's certainly something we could cover if you're interested.
My only question is, that's still ongoing then?
I think that we're probably moving pretty far along as far as things go. If you look on our website, there's an announcement about an agreement we recently made, and I'll actually paste that into the channel for you guys so you can take a look at that. We have announced with BusyBox that we're working towards a settlement with Monsoon. So that's about the most I can say about that. And what's in the press release there is pretty much all I can say, so I'll let people read that there.
Cool.
Can you, I know you're not a lawyer, but you probably have intimate knowledge of this. Can you comment at all on the Red Hat SUSE case against IP Innovation? Or is that one you're not allowed to comment on?
Yeah, I think it's better not to talk about specific litigation that's going on. I mean, I think we can have a much more useful discussion if we talk about sort of the general issues of patents relating to open source and free software.
So
that's probably a better way to talk about it.
Okay, cool. Well, maybe you can. I have some questions regarding patents against open source software and litigation similar to that, and wondering. And not citing anything specifically, but if a case, a company comes up to, brings a case to court about open source software or FOSS software infringing on their patents, is it possible, be it a company or an individual, to settle out of court in such a case, and still be within the license of the GPL or similar FOSS license, or would that require them to actually have to fight the case?
Well, it depends on the details of that settlement. I mean, as your listeners may be aware, I mean, there was a lot of discussion during the GPLv3 process with regard to the patent provisions in GPLv3, which were much more explicit than the patent provisions in GPLv2. GPLv2 operates in a really interesting way. I'm actually more of a V2 expert just because I've known it for longer, which I guess everybody has. I suppose from the point of view of most people in the world, I'm a GPLv3 expert as well, but the people I work with are much more knowledgeable about V3 than I am, but I'm probably one of the most knowledgeable people about V2. In V2, under Section 7, there's what RMS always called the give my software liberty or give it death clause, which was designed to deal with legal systems other than copyright law. Because, step back a moment, GPL is a copyright license, and it's very clear about the fact that it's only operating under the realm of copyright law. And because of that, it can't actually give you terms and conditions that affect your status under anything other than copyright law. So what it does, of course, we know that other things other than copyright law are a huge threat to free software, patents being the biggest of those. So what Section 7 in V2 did was it said, okay, we acknowledge that there are things like patent licenses out there, and we acknowledge that they may contradict the rights that you're given under the copyright license of GPL. When they do contradict that, then there's no permission for you to distribute this GPL software, copy, modify, redistribute, so forth, all the things you would be allowed to do under copyright law, if the other thing you have, whatever it is, a patent license, a court decision, whatever, contradicts this. So this is why Stallman always calls it give my software liberty or give it death. It doesn't actually have a patent protection right in it, but what it does is it makes sure that the patent system doesn't come along and trump the rights in GPL. It basically shuts down someone's ability to distribute under V2 in that case when there's a patent license that contradicts it. So in your hypothetical, where when they make that deal, they have to make sure that deal is compatible with the terms of V2 or the GPL in any case, any version. Because if they don't, they won't be allowed to engage anymore in activities such as copying, modifying, redistributing the software because the rights would trump. Now, in V3, this basically works the same way. The difference is that the details about what patent licenses have to say and how they have to work are substantially more explicit in V3 than they are in V2. So that's the key difference between those two. Because a lot of people used to call Section 7 of V2 the Rorschach test of patent licensing, because everybody looked at it and saw what they wanted. You know, a big patent holder would look at it and see it very narrow, and we in the free software would look at it and see it very broadly covering lots of different types of licensing arrangements. So what we did in the V3 process was clarify that issue. And make it clear that these are the kinds of patent licenses that are permitted by this copyright license, and these are the kinds that are not permitted by this copyright license.
Okay. So, another question on the same lines. one of the things that I look at and I see that if a lawsuit is filed against a company like Apple or Microsoft, saying that OS X or Windows or some portion of their product infringes on somebody's intellectual property, Microsoft or Apple fights that lawsuit, and generally speaking, it only targets that company and their software. Now, if a company comes after FOSS, after something that's in X or something that's in the Linux kernel, it doesn't just target one company, it affects the entire community. How would a ruling affect, a ruling against a company like SUSE or Mandriva in the United States or in any other country, how would a ruling that a piece of the distribution infringed upon somebody's patent, how would that not affect every other Linux distribution distributed in the United States or in that country where it's been found guilty automatically?
It would certainly have a clear chilling effect, because once one lawsuit has been successful in one jurisdiction, it's sometimes likely that it'll be possible elsewhere. It would depend on what jurisdiction it was in and how it happened. So if you confine it to the U.S., it's a little bit easier problem to consider. In the United States, it would certainly have a major effect, because it would mean that the judge probably awarded some sort of royalties, you know, to the person who held the patent and various other things like that. The important thing to keep in mind about software patents, and I am by no means, first of all, I'm not a lawyer, as I've mentioned and I continue to mention, because it's really important people realize that, because I do work for a legal services organization as a non-lawyer. And I'm also not, patent is not really my best area that I understand as a layperson. I know a lot much more about copyright and how it works than I do about patent, and on top of that, I'm a layperson, not a lawyer anyway. That disclaimer said, I think that it's really important to keep in mind about how these patents are written and how sort of strangely they're worded. And if you've ever tried to read one of these patents that's a so-called software patent, it's amazingly unclear even to someone experienced in the art of software development to understand what they're actually claiming. So many times when suits get that far, where the judgment's declared, the patent's substantially narrowed by the time the judgment's declared, which means it might be very easy to invent around and various other things. And it's often, you know, except for really killer patents that really kill free software, like the RSA patent is the example, although that's expired now. I always use that as sort of the patent that can actually really kill creation of free software, because it's the only way to do a particular idea. Most patents are not like the RSA patent. Most patents are so bizarre and weird what they read on that they're very easy to invent around. And they're also very easy to get re-examined. I work with a colleague here, I'll give a quick plug for his organization, named Dan Ravisher. He's on staff here at SFLC, but he also has a separate organization called the Public Patent Foundation. And what he does is re-examines bad patents that are out there, patents that are bad for society. He focuses a lot on medical patents, but he's also done a few software ones as well. He's the guy who did the re-exam on the FAT file system patent that Microsoft was waving around a while back. And he actually did really well with that re-exam. It's still an ongoing process, but it had a real chilling effect, and Microsoft's not waving that FAT file system patent around anymore. And we believe that that's one strategy that can be used to help stop patents before they start, in some sense. Once they're in the re-exam process, it's much harder for somebody to file a lawsuit and so forth over that. And we're going to be looking at that issue and ways of using that idea to help free software as the months go on here.
So what do we have to fear with regards to copyright then? Or is that more or less... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think there's two key things to keep in mind regarding copyright with free software. There's one sort of the offensive and one sort of the defensive side. On the offensive side, because that's let me start with the defensive side, because that's easier. You know, if you look at, you mentioned the Monsoon case, which we recently settled. You know, that's a great example of the defense side of copyright. You know, the reason the GPL works, and I'm pretty biased in this because I spent a lot of years doing GPL enforcement as one of my primary activities. So I feel that the reason the GPL works is because you do enforcement on it. Because when you find somebody violating the license and breaking the rules of the road of the copy left, that you go to them and say, you have to stop doing this. You have to stop treating this community badly. You have to give your code back to the community in the ways the GPL describes, and that's what we want from you. And if you notice that what we've done with BusyBox is we've helped them do that in various different places. And for every lawsuit you might see filed about GPL, there are hundreds of cases behind the scene that we settle before it ever has to get to that far. Always in enforcement of GPL, we've taken lawsuits as the last thing you do, not the first thing. You try to negotiate and convince the violator to obey the rules of the road, and it's only when they're so egregious and unfriendly about the violation, and if you read the complaint in Monsoon, you can see some of that, do we go and do anything about it in an actual court of law? But I think GPL enforcement is an incredibly important part of the copyright system that we're using. The whole reason CopyLeft works is it's using this copyright system to defend the freedoms of free software to copy, share, modify, and redistribute. And for that reason, I think it's really important that people enforce GPL. And if any of your listeners are contributors to GPL projects and they found a violation of any kind and their copyrights are involved, they should get in touch with us, and we'll try our best to help them enforce those copyrights. The FSF, by the way, has done this for many, many years. One of the things we're trying to do in SFLC is help other parties other than FSF do GPL enforcement because we think it's such an important issue. So that's the defensive side of copyright. On the offensive side, there's the whole thing that made SCO an actual fear. You know, it turns out SCO was total, you know, here, I'll use my first curse word, it was total bullshit, and we all know that now. But at the time, a lot of people were very, very frightened by the SCO case. And they were frightened because the copyright inventories of very important free software projects, Linux, the kernel included, were not very well organized. And it was not clear the chain of custody of the copyrights from the contributor into the software. And one of the things we're trying to do at SFLC is really teach projects and help them understand that you've got to keep your copyright inventory in order. One of the ways FSF has always done it is by collecting copyright assignments for every contribution. And that's something that, you know, you go back pre-SCO, and people made FSF the laughing stock for collecting copyright assignments. But the funny thing was, is I was sitting inside FSF as the whole SCO stuff started, and it actually gave me this kind of smugness about the whole copyright assignment process, because we knew that we were not in trouble on any FSF code from SCO, because we had done so much due diligence to make sure the person had the right to contribute, that they had assigned copyright to us, and that everything was clean and clear in the copyrights of the software. But so many other projects don't do that. Now, copyright assignment is not the only way to solve it. It's one tool to solve that job, and there's other tools that can be used out there. And we're hoping to educate people more, and I'm actually started putting together a document to try and help educate free software projects how to do good copyright inventorying, because we think it's so important so there's not another SCO. You know, it's really, really important that we avoid that from happening again.
Well, we did get the lawsuit regarding the patent, supposed patent infringement regarding virtual workspaces against Novell.
Yeah, and
that seems to be the next step in the progression, you know.
I mean, certainly we're well aware that the patent threat is a big one, and we really think that the most important thing here is to start really questioning some of these patents. And, I mean, everybody who's familiar with the patent system knows, at least on the business method patent side, which is where you get software patents from, that many of these patents are really bogus, and that there is prior art out there for so much of this stuff, and much of the prior art's already in older FOSS from the early 1990s, and can easily be put forward. And we think that the doing re-exams of these patents before they become weapons, right? I mean, if you disarm somebody before they start using their weapons, well, they're not going to be able to attack you. And that's the way we've been looking at the patent question. Certainly, patent litigation is a frightening thing for free software, but I really think that trying to address it from the system side, you know, questioning the way the patent system's working and trying to make sure that these patents don't stay as weapons is really the best way ongoing. You know, I've always been, and actually everybody I've talked to who have done licensing and legal leadership in the FOSS world, you know, people like myself and Evan Moglen and Richard Stallman, we try to think about these problems long term. You know, when we were thinking about SCO, what Evan was doing was going around trying to put funding together to do what we're doing now, which is SFLC, because we knew that as Evan always used to say, once there has been a SCO, there is always going to be a SCO. And what he meant by that was there's always going to be these kinds of attacks on FOSS, whether it's through the copyright system, the patent system, through whatever they want to attack it over, it's going to be out there, and that's going to be the way they come after us. They can't beat us on the technology side. You know, Microsoft is in bad shape regarding their technology, and most companies are realizing they can't do proprietary software. Even the big monolith of Oracle right behind Microsoft is getting afraid with technologies like Postgres and MySQL taking over. And so really the proprietary software companies, their last-ditch effort to stop free software is going to be through the legal system. And we're going to see lots of cases like this. I would encourage your listeners not to be alarmist about them, to instead basically ignore it. You know, I really think that's true. I mean, obviously, it's our job here to pay attention to it every day. But the thing is, I watched the whole SCO thing happen, and I mentioned this in my OOF talk, that you watch so many people just sit there and argue on Grok Law about SCO, and I think we had a real opportunity cost, that so many FOSS developers were caught up in the blow-by-blow of everything that was happening in SCO, when if all the FOSS developers had just ignored it and let, at that time, FSF and what became SFLC take care of it, I think that we all would have been better off. I mean, it's certainly our job to pay attention to these things, and we'll let you know when there's something you should pay attention to. You know, you'll hear it on our website. But I think, generally speaking, FOSS developers should do their work. They should keep their copyright inventories in order and not worry about patents until they get a threatening letter. If you sat and tried to worry about what patents are out there on the code you might be writing, you'd never actually get any code done. You'd never get anything written because there are so many patents and they read on so many different technologies, and they're actually never going to threaten your project in the end anyway, most of the patents. It's the rare patent that comes along and is a real threat to FOSS in the end. So I would encourage people, you know, copyrights, yes, you have to be very careful about that, but patents, just invent your stuff and come to us if you get a letter about a patent loss, about somebody asserting their patents on you.
I mean, we know that the patent system is broken and needs to be fixed. What can we do about it? Are there candidates out there and you know, who are up for election that are, you know, looking to reform the patent system? Or is it so removed from mainstream politics that there are no candidates to really, you know, have a stance on it either way?
I don't think it's likely that we're going to get major change in patent policy through the political process. I work for a non-political organization. We're a 501c3, which means we don't do political lobbying and that sort of thing. And the reason that I don't work for a political lobbying firm is because I don't think that's the way we're going to change the way software patents work. I think basically we're gonna focus on showing the industry, which is now certain parts of the industry, it's not the whole software industry, but there's certain places that we see out there, and if you look around, you find them, that have decided that asserting patents is going to be their business model. We have to show them that those weapons are not going to work as well as they thought they did, and that they're not going to get windfalls of large amounts of money. You know, they've tried the copyright suit. SCO was primarily it looked like it was going to be a copyright suit, although when they opened up the curtain, it turned out there was no copyrights behind it. But now we have the patent things happening, and we're eventually going to have to show that these patents are not as dangerous weapons and powerful weapons as the patent holders think they are. And I think some companies, some large patent holders even, realize this, that the patents are primarily for defensive use, not offensive use. And the wiser companies out there, I think, realize that. It's the ones that are desperate. And some companies in the proprietary world have been made desperate by the advancement of FOSS. They're going to go and try to use those patent pools as weapons against our community through various different means. The other thing I want to mention is the odds that a FOSS developer, an independent developer, is going to get sued are very, very close to zero. You know, when somebody files a patent suit, the goal is to get a lot of money in damages and licensing fees from the person they're suing. Well, it's not like your average FOSS developer has enough of resources that suing them makes it worthwhile. As you see, most patent suits that I've ever seen are filed against companies that have a large amount of money behind them because that's what they're after. So from the point of view of a FOSS developer's perspective, it's really important that they know, hey, you know, you can develop your software and maybe the company should be worried, right? If they pick up your software and you happen to have written software that, unbeknownst to you, of course, reads on a particular patent, they could be in trouble and possibly sued. But that's, to some extent, their problem. That's not your problem. You developed the software on your own. You weren't aware of the patents. You're in good shape.
I mean, you hear about the lawsuit against Red Hat and Novell with you know, the virtual spaces. That, you think about that lawsuit. I mean, as an old Commodore user, you know, I remember, you know, virtual spaces when I used my Amiga back in 1985. I mean, how long can you sue somebody for patent infringement? 17 years?
Yeah, the interesting thing is, you know, my uncle, who was also a lawyer, I remember at a very young age him saying to me, you know, the most important thing to know about litigation is you can sue anybody for anything. All it takes is walking down and filing a lawsuit at the courthouse. And the fact that somebody got sued for something, never let that be an indicator that there's something to be worried about. You mentioned judgments before. Yes, judgments are things to worry about. Lawsuits being filed, don't even pay it a mind. It doesn't mean anything until some judge rules something to be true or a jury rules something to be true. That's when you need to worry. Just following a lawsuit, don't worry about it. You're right, as a matter of fact, about the issue, general issue of prior art being out there. There are a lot of patents that are just not valid patents on the books because the patent office is incentivized to grant more patents, not fewer. And for that reason, we get lots and lots of bad patents. And I'm not that worried, frankly, about the patent issue in the general sense for FOSS, because I think we'll be able to defeat it. There's a lot of work to be done in that regard, and that's one of the things our organization set up to do, is to try and actually my colleague's organization, the Public Patent Foundation, are set up to try and call into question these bad patents. And we'll be doing more of that in the future. And I think that's going to have a real chilling effect on the likelihood these lawsuits get filed because, as you point out, there is often prior art from very old computing technology that can be used to really mess with these patents and make sure that they're not on the books anymore, or at least are called into question. You know, even if a re-exam is pending on a patent, it really hurts the ability for somebody to file a lawsuit over it because that re-exam suddenly becomes evidence, you know, about the issue.
It seems, you know, that you hear about all these companies go out and filing patents on really trivial things, you know, clicking on something that does this, you know, the way, you know, an icon interacts with a piece of software. It really seems silly that, you know, that this stuff passes, you know, and people grant them patents on it.
To quote my old boss, RMS, the patent system is a stupid, useless system. There's no question, at least with regard to software. There's no question about that. I think that we're all in agreement about that. But if you do have a lot more detailed questions on patents, you know, you should have my colleague Richard Fontana, who's one of the guys here, and he's done some patent work as well as many other things. He'd probably be a better guy to sort of, you know, dig in with your patent questions. I'm happy to tell you as much as I know. I'm a layperson, not a lawyer, so I quickly get into areas where I don't know that much. And even as a layperson, as I mentioned, I know more about copyright than I do patents. So we might want to move the discussion somewhere else, and maybe you guys could have him on at some later date to talk about the patent issue specifically.
How about the conservancy? Can you go into a little more detail what you guys are doing with that?
Oh, sure. That's an area I'm an expert in, so that's certainly much more into my depth. What we're doing in the Conservancy, I think, is a really neat thing. I mentioned when I sort of gave my spiel of my history that I was the type of volunteer that showed up and did whatever was needed. Well, the whole design of the Conservancy is to do what's needed for FOSS projects that nobody really wants to do. So the thing that the FOSS developers are really good at is writing new software, creating new things, doing development, all that sort of stuff. None of those skills translate all that well, by and large, to the administrative overhead of running an organization to fund that work or to just help that work along. So what the Conservancy does is this aggregator of projects that would like to be nonprofit entities, but don't have the infrastructure or internal leadership or even the time to do that. So a project applies to the Conservancy, and we evaluate the project as based on how successful they've been so far, and how committed the developers are, and how good the technology is, and so forth. And if we accept the project into the Conservancy, they become a member project of the Software Freedom Conservancy, which means, first of all, we provide administrative services to handle things like the books when they get donations, to process donations and make sure that that the money's in the bank account and that it's paid out when a developer goes on a trip to a conference, that they get their cost reimbursed when they submit the receipts and so forth. We also provide the corporate infrastructure is what I mean, as a 501c3 charity in the United States. So if their community wants to donate money to the project, they can donate to the Conservancy, earmarked for that project, and then that project's able to receive tax-deductible donations, at least in the United States, for funding their work and various things that they're doing in the development side. So it's a way of getting that administrative overhead out of the hands of the projects who oftentimes don't have the resources to do it. And I think that that's a really great way for projects to be able to get a pool of money and get donations on the Internet and PayPal and so forth and fund back to the work that they're doing. The other piece that the Conservancy does is it provides some level of liability shield for developers. So when they publish the software under a free software license, they're publishing it under the auspices of the Conservancy. So the Conservancy, although they're still the copyright holder by and large, the Conservancy takes on some of the liability with that. It's a relatively thin shield, but it is a little bit of something more than they certainly would get as a independent developer publishing that software.
So you guys are doing a real great service to people, different software projects that are looking for help in different areas.
Yeah, we're trying to. I mean, that's why we built both organizations, because what the Conservancy does is it provides those administrative services I was just talking about, financial services, that sort of thing. And then the Software Freedom Law Center is here to provide the legal services. So between the two organizations, we can provide somewhat of a one-stop shop for what projects need outside of the actual software development part of it. That's our hope anyway. I think most of our projects have been pretty happy with the services that they've got. I know the BusyBox guys are very happy. So they've told me that a number of times. So that's certainly good. I'm glad that we've been able to help them out. I've known those guys for so many years, and I worked with them a lot when I was at FSF and trying to do GPL enforcement and help them with it. And I'm so glad that we're getting the work done for them and it's happening.
Yeah, BusyBox is a great project. A lot of embedded developers use their stuff.
Yep, yeah.
And apparently companies do too.
Quite a few. I mean, it's sort of that's the classic example of the GPL violator is the embedded device manufacturer who just doesn't get FOSS, and they hired some outside party to develop the software, and they didn't even know it was FOSS when they started. And then their first argument to us is, well, we didn't know, so it's not our fault. Well, you were the publisher of the software. You're the one infringing the copyright. The other guys might have been infringing copyright when they shipped it to you, too, and we're happy to talk to them, but you guys have an obligation to your users to give them the complete and corresponding source code. So GPL enforcement, I find it a very enjoyable activity. It's really the teeth of the copyleft and what makes the community defend it in a legal sense. And I've done quite a bit of it, and almost all of it's been successful. Some of it hasn't been, but by and large, it's all been successful. And I think it's just a great service to do the community. I just love doing that. Even after 10 years of doing GPL enforcement, I still love doing. I just was working on two GPL enforcement cases today. I just love doing that work.
Are you all?
What do you guys hear? Go ahead, Dan.
Are you at all involved with the DRM, anti-DRM initiatives?
No, that's a Free Software Foundation thing. The guy who took over from me when I left, named Peter Brown, launched a couple of different campaigns at FSF, which I thought were really great. The anti-DRM campaign, the Play Aug campaign, the Bad Vista campaign, those are a couple of things they've done since I've left. I think they're wonderful campaigns. I'm glad they're doing them. It's not the thing we do. They're just a client of ours from my point of view now. I mean, they're just somebody who comes to us for legal services. But I think they're great campaigns. And we were really happy to help FSF to draft the anti-DRM language in GPLv3, and we're very happy with how that came out. I think it was a great way to deal with that issue in a license, and we're pretty glad about the result.
Back to possible GPL violations and how you guys hear about them. Do you guys have like a hotline, or is there just a general email that people send you possible violations?
I'm laughing because once years ago when I did an enforcement effort at FSF, somebody posted a comment to Slashdot of a fictional thing where Stallman was Batman and I was Robin doing GPL enforcement. So when you said hotline, it made me think of that. You can probably Googleable somewhere on Slashdot. I think generally the way you should deal with GPL enforcement, if you discover a violation yourself, is find out who the copyright holder is of the software that's being violated. So the key thing to know, to always remember about GPL, is it's a copyright license, which means that the right to enforce, the right to control what happens with enforcement lies completely in the hands of the copyright holder. So when you discover a violation yourself because you bought some product and you discovered that it has some looks like GPL stuff in there, the first thing you do is, oh, who owns copyright on that? Now, if it's an FSF or GNU program, you can write to the FSF, and there's an address license-violation at FSF.org for their stuff. Now, if it's BusyBox, for example, then there's actually an email address you can write to for BusyBox, and I'll pull that up. I don't remember. It actually goes to me, as it turns out. But I don't remember what the published address actually is. So I'm looking on the BusyBox. So I think it's, I type it in, I think it's gpl@busybox.net for BusyBox GPL violation. And now those are the only two projects. And actually, if it's Harold Velto's copyright, you can contact him through gplviolations.org. Which is his website for GPL violations. But those are the only three various places that I know that actually have sort of defined places to contact when you discover a GPL violation. Most of the time what you need to do is find out who the copyright holder is, write to them and say, look, I found this GPL violation. If you would like to enforce this, I'm happy to give you all the data I have about your violation. And by the way, you might want to contact my buddies over at the Software Freedom Law Center to help you do the enforcement. Because obviously some of the requests we get are people who've discovered a GPL violation in their own copyrights and asking for help. But I make a real clear distinction here. If you as the person who discovered the violation were to send us a report, we wouldn't be able to do anything because you're not the copyright holder. So we can't represent you as a legal team to help you enforce it because you actually, as the user, have no standing. I've always felt kind of an unfortunate thing that the users don't actually have legal standing to enforce GPL. It's a very unfortunate thing, but it's sort of the system we have. We don't have much choice. That's the way copyright works. So you have to get in touch with the copyright holder.
How often do you guys get, were there reports coming in of possible violations? Was it, sporadic, once in a blue moon, every week?
Well, we aren't the people generally. I mean, the only people I can speak for is BusyBox because I actually do the work to collect their violations. Generally speaking, we aren't, as I was saying, we aren't receiving the reports. BusyBox has received a lot actually since the Monsoon lawsuit was filed. That spurred a lot of new reports. We have about a dozen cases open for BusyBox right now. I can't really comment much more beyond that because it's stuff we're doing for them. When I was at FSF back in the day, at any given time, I would have about 30 to 40 violations open. We cleared somewhere between 30 and 50 each year that I was there. I was there from 2001 until 2005. that's sort of it. I think Brett Smith, who works doing the GPL enforcement now at FSF, has posted numbers in his blog on FSF's site if you want to see how much FSF does as far as GPL enforcement issues. But I'm pretty sure that there are many, many violations out there that go unreported. I think when people, when you get a device, some new device that's really cool, that does something, you know, anybody who's listening, right? If you get a device, spend some time looking at the firmware again and sort of poking around, seeing what's on there. Obviously, don't violate any agreements that you agreed to when you bought the device, but at least give a quick once-over to see if it's BusyBox in there or any kind of GPL software that you recognize or know about. It's usually pretty easy to find out that, and discover that it's a Linux-based system with BusyBox just by like logging into the router or something like that. You can find out. But I encourage people to keep an eye out for that. You know, I discover them every so often. I just on my own personal research, when I'm looking at some software system on a website, I say, wait a second, and I run strings on the binary, and lo and behold, there's somebody's free software copyright notice in there. You know, most GPL violators are not very smart. You know, the key tool that I use to find GPL violations is strings-a, and grep for project name or copyright holder or whatever.
Well, wasn't the old Linksys WRT54 router one of those cases where they were using Linux on the router, and they got caught and they had to release the source code, and as a result, a lot of us, you know, have those routers, including myself.
Yep.
It's completely hackable. It's a great thing. It's one of the things I love.
Yep. Yeah, that was the case I did actually that I was the lead on at back when I was at FSF. It's funny, as you were talking to me, I turned around and looked at my back wall, which I have this little thing of it's a box from one of those routers with a little notice on the front that says this stuff has open source in it, that's subject to GPL. And next to it, I have a little arrow pointing to it that says GPL enforcement in action. I'm particularly proud of that case. It was a very difficult case to solve. It was made more difficult by the fact that Linksys had just been acquired by Cisco, and there was just complete confusion in the management structure and trying to talk to the right people and trying to work with them and so forth. It was made even worse that as we were trying behind the scenes to keep it from escalating too much, the story made Slashdot in the middle of when we were in negotiations, and everybody on Slashdot was talking about it. And the ironic thing is a lot of times when GPL violations become public in the early stages, it actually hurts the compliance effort because the companies kind of clam up and get scared, whereas if you do it clandestinely but quietly with them and try to see if they want to be friendly first before it becomes public, you're usually in a better spot. So the Linksys case was really difficult. It was the first time I built a coalition of copyright holders. It was really kind of interesting. What happened was, of course, there was FSF copyrighted code in there, but BusyBox was also in there. This actually counts the first time I worked with the BusyBox guys back in 2003, I think it was, because the BusyBox code was in there, Howard Velta's code was in there from the Linux kernel. There were so many different copyright holders. And once it hit Slashdot, they all got really interested and sort of inundated Linksys with nastygrams. And what we did at FSF at the time, this was before SFLC existed, realized, so there wasn't sort of a single legal services organization to deal with the issue as a whole at one time. So we at FSF built a coalition. And as you know, some people, even in the GPL world, are not huge fans of my old boss, you know, and it was a lot of negotiation I had to do to sort of get people comfortable with the idea of FSF aggregating the claims and doing a single enforcement effort. And this is and the reason this was so important is an issue people might not realize about GPL v2. Once you violate GPL version 2, you are prohibited from distributing, copying, and modifying that software anymore ever, until such time as the copyright holder restores your rights to engage in those activities. So what happens in those cases is, once they violate it, each copyright holder has to individually restore their rights, technically speaking, before they can engage in their usual business again. So when you have lots of copyright holders, from the point of view of the violator, if lots of copyright holders are coming after you, you realize you have to settle with all of them in sequence to get the problem solved if they're all angry at you. So that's a really difficult thing. GPL v3 does this a little bit differently. You have sort of a grace period time. If you fix the violation in a certain period of time, you can get your rights restored automatically. But in V2, that wasn't there. So when it's a V2 violation, you know, they really get worried when there's lots of copyright holders. So we worked at FSF to aggregate the claims about the Linksys router, and we actually were able to get it enforced and get it solved. I think it was, it's one of the, that and another case called OpenTV are the two that I'm proudest of that I did while I was at FSF. Those were both really, really important cases that I was really glad to get resolved and were a whole lot of work to get solved.
Yeah, Linksys eventually on that router from version 5 forward, they put their own closed firmware on it, and it's pretty much a consensus that that product has suffered for it. People mm-hmm. still go out and try to get those routers from like eBay secondhand.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the only wireless routers I use myself for those same reasons. I only use those older Linksys ones that can have that firmware. And I think it was around the end of 2006 when they mid 2006 I think when they finally retired the GL line that was out there, which I know they must have named for GNU/Linux. I just know that's why they called it the GL. to make the reference back to GNU Linux, I think it's an example of how I think a lot of the acrimony that happened on Slashdot and stuff was a factor in that. This is one of the reasons I always try to get GPL violation cases resolved quickly and just privately with the violator between the copyright holders and the violator, because one of the things is when they get shamed like that in public, it sort of turns them off from open source and free software. I see every GPL violation as, initially at least, as an education opportunity, as a place to say, look, you screwed up, you know, you didn't understand the rules, let's talk about it. And it's only when we do something egregious in response to that, like, you know, delay you for months and months, or refuse to work with you, or say nasty things on their website about, or make promises that they're going to release the source and don't, and that sort of thing, when I think you have to get a little aggressive. But I think the initial contact always ought to be, look, you need to come into compliance, and we want to help you do it, and we're here to help you, and we want to work with you. And that's always been the attitude of my strategy towards GPL enforcement. And I think when the acrimony starts, as it did with Linksys, it can turn a company off from doing more FOSS, and I think that's what happened to some extent with Linksys, although there's another factor there, which is that Cisco has always been a very somewhat unfriendly to free and open source software company, and I think it could be somewhat of their influence over Linksys that's caused that, but that's just my own personal speculation about why that might be.
Well, you guys are doing fantastic work, and we appreciate everything that you've done.
Well, we try, certainly. Our hope is, and if people want to support us, they can go to our website at softwarefreedom.org, and there's a donate link there that they can support us if they want to. Most of our support comes from industry companies who give large donations, but every little bit helps, of course. And as a 501c3, our goal is to be a public organization, so we want the support from the public as well, if people are willing.
Bradley, just to go back, you were talking about that story about RMS. Do you want to talk about that now?
I forget which. There's so many RMS stories. You know, I could spend an hour telling you RMS stories.
But you probably got the dirt on him because you were his personal assistant for several years.
I was his personal assistant for a year and a half, and then he named me vice president. Oh, yes, that was the story of how he made me vice president. So so I went to him. We were actually at a conference in Paris, in France, in the very beginning of 2001. And he had just, being in 2001, and he had just said he was going to hire me. And I said, okay, well, that sounds great. I said, but I really can't be your assistant anymore because, you know, when I write to GPL violators and that sort of thing, they don't take me seriously. He goes, well, why don't you just be the vice president? And it was just immediate like that. Maybe I already told the story. Oh, the other story I was going to tell you. I just remembered the other one. That was a story about when I lost it again. Oh, man. I'll think of it in a second. Ask me something else, and I'll remember that story.
Does it involve rolling around in the offices in the conference room?
I have never seen that. So,
fist fighting like Bill Hurd told us.
You know, I listened to Bill. I really love Bill Hurd's stories, and I've heard people talk about RMS in that sort of way, but that's not something that I really think. I certainly never saw it. I mean, RMS is really. he's really a sweet, kind guy, and a lot of people don't realize that because, I mean, he has very strong rhetoric, and his rhetoric is very important to him, so it comes across as extremely aggressive to some people and sometimes even off-putting. But once you get to know him as a person, he's a very, I mean, he really believes in what he says. He believes in freedom and he believes in people's individual freedoms, and he wants to be very accommodating to other people and their needs and so forth. So I've always felt that about RMS, I think he's a very misunderstood guy. In some ways, he's a very tragic figure because, you know, he started this whole thing and this whole free software movement to recreate the community that he had at MIT of developers. And I think all of us who have become FOSS developers in the years, you know, since he did that have experienced that. I certainly have experienced the amazing communities that have been created. But for RMS, because he spends all his time, you know, doing the advocacy and rhetoric work, he doesn't get a lot of time, doesn't have a lot of time to spend being a software developer in the free software community he helped create. And it's actually kind of tragic. I feel bad for him that he doesn't get to spend more time doing software development. You know, one of the reasons people say, you know, oh, he shouldn't maintain Emacs himself anymore, he should be able to maintain Emacs for as long as he likes. I mean, it's his one opportunity to be involved on a regular basis in free software development, and I would never begrudge him that, because he deserves to benefit from the wonders of community that it creates that all of us benefit from every day. You know, he doesn't get to see it as much as we do, ironically, as it turns out.
We had a question come in a long time ago. Maybe you could answer this. Who, in the realm of politics, who would the your organization or the FSF be backing in next year's election?
Well, so that's exactly something. This can turn quickly into a primer on how nonprofit organizations work in the U.S. There are various different classifications of nonprofit organizations. The one that goes the furthest as far as like tax deductibility and not being required to pay taxes is the 501c3 classification. They're all 501c something, and 501c3 is what we are and what FSF is, by the way. And one of the things you're prohibited from doing as an organization that's a 501c3 is getting involved in lobbying or endorsing political candidates or anything related to politics. So you'll find that neither FSF nor SFLC nor Software Freedom Conservancy, for that matter, will ever endorse a candidate or otherwise, talk about, you know, issues of political lobbying or whether this bill is bad or that bill is good or so forth. That's not the kind of activity 501c3s are set up to engage in. So for that reason, we have no comment on that issue.
I guess a better organization would be the EFF.
No, actually, EFF's a 501c3 as well. It's actually something that of all people I saw mentioned, our good old friend Eric Raymond tried to do, was set up a lobbying organization for open source, free software, technology issues. I don't think he ever really got going on that. He was called Geek PAC, for a while, and he was interested in getting that going. But unfortunately, it never really got off the ground. But I think it's actually a good idea, and if somebody's interested in sort of in lobbying and has some you need some connections to do lobbying generally. But if somebody's really into that, going to D.C. and starting that kind of organization is a good thing. Well, you know, the AARP itself was very small once. I mean, every organization starts small. And every organization has has issues with that, and I think that starting out small and trying and trying to get the funding over time is the best way to do it. I mean, AARP is a great example. It's funded almost exclusively by people over 50 who want to get cheap rates on hotels, for that reason they're one of the most powerful lobbying organizations in Washington. And they started like anybody else with somebody with an idea. So I think it's possible to do that and actually make it happen. It just requires a lot of dedication and a lot of sacrifice. First of all, you have to live in D.C. if you have to be want to do that. So some people might not want to do that. But once you live in D.C., if you have time, it's worth a try. I think I would love to see somebody try and do it. And I think the money would show up eventually if somebody got a team together that was really good at it, but at this point there really is none, and it's too bad.
Yeah, a lot of these issues for us, in the geek community, comes to the forefront, and it's just going to get bigger as time goes on, and technology is more integrated in people's lives than it is now. I mean, even now it is a lot; it's really integrated into people's lives, but it's just going to increase, as the years progress.
Yeah, I really, you know, it's one of the things I used to say, and if people read some, or read transcripts or listen to some of my old speeches on web, one of the things I used to talk about in the speeches I used to give at universities back when I was FSF was to talk about the issue of why computer science exists. You know, I really think computers exist to make people's lives better. And I find so often that particularly proprietary software sort of does the opposite. It makes people's lives more annoying and more difficult and so forth. And I think that the promise of free and open source software is the promise of using computing technology to really make people's lives better and really improve the quality of life. And I think you can't do that with proprietary software. I just think proprietary software never does that for people. I've never seen it in my travels that somebody's lives made inherently better by proprietary software. It's free software that I see having a real impact in improving people's lives, particularly in the industrializing world. You know, I mean, in Africa, it's not gonna help you much to get a proprietary software system. You need a system you can learn from. Because you're not going to have the infrastructure of education that you do in the U.S. to learn computer science. But anybody who has a computer, some electricity, which is sometimes hard in Africa, and a brain can learn about FOSS because they just read the source code and learn how it works. And that's something you just can't do with proprietary software. I find it scandalous, actually. Here's where you find out how close I am to RMS sometimes. I find it scandalous that we teach proprietary stuff in computer science programs. I mean, it's like giving somebody a book of Shakespeare and saying, we're going to study Shakespeare, but you don't open the text of Hamlet. You don't look at that. I'm just going to tell you all about what Hamlet does and how he talks, but you can't actually read the source text. No, that's not how we learn Hamlet. Nobody would do that in an English department, but in the computer science department, they give you a proprietary system and say, we're going to spend a whole semester using this proprietary system.
Bradley, we had a question on the IRC. Someone wants to know what distro you use.
I started with SLS in 1991, or 92 rather, and that doesn't exist anymore. It became Slackware. I was a Slackware user from 1993 or so, maybe four, up until maybe 96. When I switched to Red Hat. I used Red Hat from 96 until, I think, 1998. Then I switched to Debian. I used Debian pretty much straight through until was it Hori the first time I installed Ubuntu, I think? And I primarily switched to Ubuntu from Debian because of the release cycle. Two things, because of the release cycle and because Ubuntu had done such a job getting it working on desktops. I'm a Debian person through and through. The community aspect of Debian's good. I love the DFSG. So I'm very, very tied, you know, sort of personally to the Debian community. But Ubuntu's just done such a good job at getting the desktop working, you know, when I have a lot of people here. You know, one of the other sides of what I do, other than the stuff we've been talking about, is I'm also, you know, the chief technology officer of SFLC, so I have to decide what the technology is inside the organization. And when I have a bunch of people on laptops, Ubuntu is really where I have to go. I can't do a straight Debian. In fact, Richard Fontana, the colleague I mentioned a little while ago, asked me recently, why is it that we don't run straight Debian? And I said, well, the desktop thing is really an issue. I think Ubuntu's got that down really well, better than Debian does at this moment. So.
Frank from the RC keeps asking, who do you support in the coming election? He keeps bringing up the political questions.
Yeah, you know, I happen to be lucky to live in a country where my vote's private. You can guess by my mannerisms, the way I talk and the way I think, and the fact that I live in New York City that I'm probably pretty liberal leaning, there's no question about that. But I don't think I'm ready to endorse a candidate. Even speaking for myself, let alone the organization, which wouldn't do that anyway. Sorry, Frank.
Good for you, Bradley, for stonewalling them.
That's right.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's funny. I spent so much time. You know, even at FSF, I was working heavily with Eben Moglen and Dan Ravisher, who are my colleagues here now at SFLC. And I sort of learned to pretend like I was a lawyer, even though I'm not a lawyer. I sort of have that way of answering questions. You know. Yeah, it's lawyers and poker players love to answer questions with it depends. That's anytime you ask them a question about what they do, the answer is it depends. And I like to answer that. I like to answer that way. I think it's very true. I think people love it when people give hard and fast answers, but mainly because people usually jumble over themselves when they try to give a hard and fast answer. I think most things in life are very nuanced, and it takes a lot of time to discuss things. And one of the reasons I like your show is that it's so long, and the guests can spend a really long time. It's like I keep talking about your interview with Bill Hurd. I mean, it was just excellent to hear him talk at length about how things were. You know, I mean, you can hear sort of sound bites about things that have happened or so forth, but actually getting into a lengthy discussion and really hearing lots of detail, I think, is a way to really understand how issues are and how they work. And that's one. I don't really believe in concision. I'm very much a speaker that likes to talk and talk and talk, because I think there are so many issues that come up when you think about anything important that it's important to not sort of just be focused on a single clear-cut answer. There's never a single clear-cut answer for most things.
When Dan is done editing this recording down, your talk will be about 10, 15 minutes or so.
Look, I have a bunch of your podcasts on my player, and I know for a fact they're always 2 hours and 15 minutes, or I admit to having sped through a few of them.
What kind of player do you have?
I own a Neuros. Does that help? I actually own an iPod that I got for free, so I don't know if that exonerates me from the evilness. I got it for free from actually playing poker, so I used to use always a Neuros until I got the iPod for free. I think I paid too much for it, to tell you the truth, but
you should burn that.
Boy,
iPod.
I need the crickets for that joke, huh?
Yeah, the Apple is evil.
Yeah, I'm not a fan, but Rockbox is really excellent. They did an excellent job, and it runs on pretty much all the hardware, so I really like their stuff. They've done a great job.
So is that what you're running on the iPod, the Rockbox?
Yeah, we've got a couple of Rockbox things around here. My colleague Aaron was actually the first to get working on his iPod. The video stuff does not work too well with it, but it's really cool. It's really cool stuff. I was a big fan of the Neuros. You know, I mean, Neuros has excellent ideas. I think they've had a lot of buggy stuff. I mean, the Neuros audio player, which is what I used from basically, I guess, 2002 or 3, somewhere around there, until as recently as about 6 months ago. I really like they play all natively, all that cool stuff, but the software is really kind of buggy, and it's been pretty tough. And it looks like Neuros is out of the audio player business, which is too bad. I guess Rockbox is there now, so it's not so bad that we don't have a hardware manufacturer is also for freedom. Excuse me, but hey. I was glad that they were there for that amount of time that they were, just to be out there and be a hardware manufacturer that wants to do stuff as free software. Wow, people in your IRC channel do not like Rockbox.
Yeah, they got all different names for it.
Yeah, I see that. I think it's important to be an early adopter of FOSS and to really give feedback. I especially encourage this for students and people who have a lot. Most students think they're always busy, but students have a ton of time on their hands. And I was an early adopter of a lot of things. I used to run a lot of stuff out of CVS when I was a student. I don't do as much of it as I used to, not much to my chagrin. But running stuff out of CVS and running new stuff and experimenting with new technology and giving bug reports, it really gives the developers a feeling of and desire to make it better. You know, if they don't have a big user base, they're not going to be inspired to work on it. I mean, Rockbox in particular is a very volunteer oriented development project, and they need support. Obviously they probably need donations as well, but also sort of community support and interest and excitement to feel like hey, people are using our project, we want to keep going. So I encourage the folks who are complaining about it to give them a try. And give them bug reports, and try and help them out. I actually tried to donate. That's the funny story about that iPod that I now embarrassingly own. I tried to donate it to them initially, but they didn't need it, so I had to keep it, I guess, because I was going to donate it to them because it was not supported originally when I first got it. It's the fifth gen one, but They didn't need it. So I got on the RC channel. I was like, hey, do you guys want this? I'll send it to you. You know, I want you guys to have it. And they said, no, we got enough. I was like, okay. I guess I have to keep it.
As long as it works, you use it.
So I'm still forgetting. I wonder why I forgot that RMS story so quickly. I mean, there's so many RMS stories that I could tell lots of them. You have to tell me what genre of RMS story you want.
We want the dirt.
We want to know, does RMS ever use any proprietary codecs to view his media?
It's funny. I got an email from him about.
From Outlook.
About, I guess, seven... No, I get my email from... He still uses... You want to hear about RMS's email. RMS still uses RMail. And RMail, as far as... At least a couple of years ago, maybe it's better now, cannot handle attachments natively. So he saves stuff to the shell and then runs the software to get the attachment out by hand, like at the shell prompt. And I'm just, like, amazed that he still uses RMail. You know, it's like... I mean... I read my email in Emacs, too. I use GNUs. But the fact that he's that tied to the RMail that he wrote, that he's still using that, I just am in pain when I watch him check his email. So, now, his email always comes from RMail. But he asked me about the codecs issue. He said, if WXVLC can play something, does that mean the codec's free? And I gave him the best answer I could think of, which seemed to me that it's probably true that the implementation is free software, but it could be a patent-encumbered format. So he thinks about this question on a regular basis, that he's always worried about making sure that he's using free formats and so forth. You know, I used to be like him in that regard. I used to feel like I shouldn't use patent-encumbered formats. My feeling now is any format that has a free software implementation, even if it's patent-encumbered, I'm pretty comfortable with using. I think we should try to support the patent-free formats as much as possible. I think players should support AUG equally with MP3. I support the Play AUG campaign that FSF has, but I'm less worried about that personally myself. You know, I don't think you need to make that statement all the time. The important thing is to talk about the issue, like we're doing right now, to talk about, hey, don't forget, MP3 is a patent-encumbered format. Don't lose that from your mind. There's a reason that it's in multiverse, not in universe on Ubuntu. It's because it's patent-encumbered, at least encoding is. And it's important to make people aware that and AUG's really a better format. The AUG Vorbis, I think, is a better audio format. They sound better, I think, for the same file size. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good question. I just saw go through your channel. Why does Totem not work that well? I'm translating out the cursing. I've wondered that myself too.
Well, you know what? What's worse than Totem is the Totem plugin for Firefox.
My God.
Oh, I know. I click on that, and I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I just download something and play it with WXVLC because I'm like, I can't make this thing work. I don't understand why. I mean, it's a default for GNOME, I guess, and it's very, very frustrating. I've had that problem many times myself. It used to be, and actually in Dapper, I think Totem would not read the audio right, and it would like lock up your audio sometimes. It was horrible.
Just still horrible.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of VLC. It's funny, I remember the day the VLC project was launched. It was launched by a bunch of guys in Paris, and it was that very conference where Stallman appointed me vice president. They announced that they were releasing VLC code from this university in France. So it's exciting to see that. You know, I mean, I've been around the FOSS community long enough now that there are projects that are really important to us and big important projects now have been there when it all started is really kind of cool. It's really awesome to see that FOSS has come, how far it's come. Just in the, I mean, I've been involved with it since 1991 or so. Just to see how far it's come since then, it's just amazing. I mean, I'm just really proud of our community as a whole. We've just done such awesome work. We should all be really proud of it.
Yep, it's good, and it's only getting better.
Now, what?
I mean, that's the hope. It takes us longer. I mean, it takes longer to do stuff by a community process than it does if you have just a bunch of people to order around. But I think the result is so much better because the software really addresses users' needs, and it really is maintainable, and it works well. It's just such an advantage. You know, I mean, I don't mind that GNOME took this long to catch up with Microsoft as desktop, because I think the GNOME desktop as it's come out is so much better than anything Microsoft's ever had, and I just think that's wonderful. And yeah, it took us 10 years to actually get it good, but now that it's good, it really, really works well.
You know, if you're so highly impressed with Totem, what's your opinion of Rhythmbox?
I have never used Rhythmbox at all. To tell you the truth, I heard you guys talking, I think on your last show or something, about XMMS. You know, I still use XMMS.
No, we were talking about XMMS before the show.
Oh, before the show. I can't remember. I was actually, earlier today, I was listening to your last show.
Oh.
So I actually am confused by what we were talking about before the show started. And on the show I was listening to this morning on my commute. But the thing is, I don't listen to audio much on my computer itself. I mostly listen to it on the box. So, on the portable device. So I'm not really playing a lot of audio. I don't listen to music anymore either. I kind of hate music now. So I stopped listening to music somewhere around 2002 or so, and I haven't really listened to it since. So I only listen to podcasts and that sort of thing.
See, I would have pegged you for a Banshee guy.
Banshee, I installed that for my wife once and got her working with it, but I don't think she liked it. She doesn't play music on her computer either. She's also on her player as well.
And you manage your photos with F-Spot, don't you?
I don't take any photos. My wife uses Flickr, I must admit. And she uses whatever comes up by default in GNOME to get it off the camera. Something comes up by default, I forget what it is. So,
G-Thumb.
Yeah, you guys want to hear something really crazy about software? You should ask me about my email setup.
What's your email setup?
Oh, it's so nasty.
Evolution?
Evolution. It's just that, yeah, that would be really disgusting in a different way. I'm talking about, like, the level of hoops my email goes through. Okay, so I have my email on an IMAP server, which is the softwarefreedom.org IMAP server. I copy it over to my own laptop using offline IMAP, which is a great program, written by John Gertz, I think is his name. It's a great program. I may have just butchered his name, but he wrote a great program. He's a Debian guy from way back, and a great programmer. So I use that to get the mail onto my laptop. Then what I use to read my mail is GNU's, but GNU's best sort of interface to read email is through IMAP. So I run my own local instance of Dovekit against my own files in my own home directory to feed GNU's the email from that came through from offline IMAP.
Huh?
Is that crazy or what? Yeah, so basically, because GNU's is best at reading over to an IMAP server, but it's faster to read from localhost than it is from there, I download the email with offline IMAP and then run the IMAP server locally so that GNU's can talk to the IMAP server locally to read the email. This also allows me to read my email offline even though it's on an IMAP server. So that's part of it. It's really, really, really crazy. But it's not as crazy what I used to do, which is what I used to run MUT inside an ANSI term inside Emacs.
Ah,
yeah, I'm crazy with the email. There's no question at all. And I use Marex to index it for searching. So then I have yet another tool. I try to use every possible email tool that's ever come across my path all at once. That's sort of my goal with email. I really people's heads hurt on the IRC channel. Yeah. But I think our community would do better to do a lot less email anyway. I think we spend a lot of time sending each other email when we should be doing other things. I'm not a fan of email anymore.
Like all the spam, so we should be reading the spam mail that you get instead of sending more.
Yeah, well, for spam, I use dspam on the server, which is really excellent. I've been really impressed with it. If you give it a good, you know, 500 messages each of ham and spam as an initial training set, it'll just rock as far as how well it does at getting the spam filtering right. I've been really impressed. We're using it for everybody here at SLC. And I even set up a little plugin for Dovekit that's on their wiki that allows you to retrain a message by saving it to a folder called spam. And when you move it out of the folder called spam, it trains it back as ham. So it's kind of a neat way. The IMAP server actually does all the training on the server for it. It's really cool. I've been really happy with that. As far as MTAs go, I'm a postfix guy through and through. I've seen XM, but I like postfix better.
It sounded like you were about to ask something before I cut you off.
Oh, I was going to ask something?
I thought it was you.
Yeah, I was going to ask what the whole thing about Link hating Freedom. I just saw on the channel Link uses Pine because he hates Freedom. What's the whole? I noticed that's like a running gag with you guys. How did that start?
Because I think Link hates Freedom. Encounters with RMS.
Oh, really? I did not find that show. I guess he must have been on the show once and
twice.
Something like that.
He's been on twice, and the second time, Link asked him a question about, you know, how does a person make money, you know, coding software, and it got into a real heated discussion. I think everybody was a little tired and cranky, and it didn't go too well. So, you know, everybody was goofing on him, telling him that he hated Freedom, and it just kind of continued and snowballed to this day.
Yeah, you know, sometimes my boss now, Eben Moglen, has characterized Stallman as the person who should be the Pope of the free software movement. And I think that's actually a good classification, you know. I mean, that's sort of where the position where he's really important. I'm glad he's there and so radical because he makes other people look moderate. You know, it's Brian Benneldorf, you might know from the Apache Project. He's since done other things, but he's best known for that. He told me once when I was working for FSF, he said, you know, I'm so glad FSF's there because if it wasn't, I would look like a moderate. I would look like a radical. Instead, I look like a moderate. So what Brian's saying basically is he can be the guy, the business open source person, because FSF exists and is the radical element. You know, I think every movement needs its radical element, right? I mean, if you look at other types of social movements, you look at things like the animal rights movement. You have PETA, which is the far, far radical left of the animal rights movement. I don't really agree with PETA myself, even though I'm a vegetarian. I'm very, very, very far from personally agreeing with PETA, in much the way that many people are in the FOSS world, but very, very far from agreeing with RMS. And I think it takes a lot of people to make a movement, and we need all aspects all the way around. I think it's key, you know. So yeah, does it make you feel any better, Link, that used to be the joke? That's actually the running gag at FSF.
Link is actually not here tonight.
Oh yeah, I hadn't heard his voice. I was wondering. Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't feeling too well.
Okay, well, hopefully it'll make him feel better to know that's also the reason I was so interested in that Hates Freedom thing is because that's the running gag inside FSF. Like, anytime somebody says something, the big joke is, you're going to run X Emacs because you hate Freedom, because you're not running GNU Emacs right now. So yeah, that just became a whole gag inside FSF a long time ago. Very soon after I got there, that became a running gag. That's one that we know well. You know, you hate Freedom because of X.
I think the flip side of that is some people, you know, view the people that, you know, cry, you know, so-and-so hates Freedom as kind of a zealot. And it's a kind of a goof on that, too, in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I've never heard RMS say, you know, so-and-so hates Freedom.
No, I've never heard either.
Yeah, I think Stallman has very strong opinions, but he doesn't really hold other people. As much as his rhetoric comes off as aggressive, he doesn't hold other people to have to believe what he believes. He doesn't like it when people use terminology that he doesn't agree with and so forth. You know, and if he heard how much I say open source these days, he'd probably be unhappy with me. But I think he's actually had a really important point regarding that, and I think that he understands that people should be able to use the words they want to use and do the things they want to do, but that they should be aware, you know, of the issues, and that's the thing that's most important to him, is getting across, you know, and encouraging people to pay attention to the issues that he's bringing up. So yeah, I mean, I think he's a very misunderstood guy. And he's a great guy to get along with. And by the way, somebody asked in the channel, the funny thing is that I never started calling him RMS until recently. I always called him Richard. And the reason I started calling RMS is during the GPLv3 process, one of the attorneys here who worked on GPLv3 is also named Richard. His name is Richard Fontana. And we got into, like, deep confusion with Richard said this or Richard said that because there was two Richards. So I started calling Richard RMS or Stallman, and we started calling Richard Fontana Fontana. So that's when I actually started. I've always called him Richard primarily, and RMS is a new thing for me. actually. Although he introduces himself as RMS, generally speaking.
You know what, Bradley? I want to make a comment because we're getting close to the half hour mark that's in the show, and I want to just make a comment about something this week, and also probably get your opinion on these devices, but not at the risk of changing the topic very drastically. Pat really bummed me out this week by his posting of the debacle surrounding the Neo 1973. OpenMoko phone that apparently it will not work on the frequencies, the 850 frequency, I think it is, in the United States, because it only has a tri-band chip in there that supports, what is it, Pat, 900, or is it 800, or 900, and 1900, and another frequency?
It's 850, 900, 1800. Most of the world uses the 1800.
Yeah.
Especially in Europe, they use that. In the United States, we use 850, and we also use the 1800 as well, or the 1900, I forget. The thing is that the 1900 is not as supported and as common as the 850 megahertz frequency. So you might be able to use it in certain urban areas and bigger cities, but if you go, you know, like for instance, I live in the Lehigh Valley, which is kind of, you know, in between New York City and Philadelphia, more than likely it wouldn't work for me. I was bummed out too, Dan. You know, I was really looking forward to possibly getting one of these OpenMoko phones, you know, when the next generation came out. But I don't think I am, to be honest, you know.
It doesn't support the 850, right?
Yeah, and most of the Western Hemisphere uses the 850 band. That's a big chunk of the world that they're bypassing.
And I was so looking forward
to this. Yeah, I mean, I know that they had, we had some meetings with the OpenMoko guys when they came through the U.S. on their sort of the roadshow tour, and they were really struggling with getting a chip set that they could put in the device and was being, you know, cleared with the FCC and various other things. It's been a really difficult project for them, I think, from the hardware perspective, and they've had a lot of trouble, I think. I'm glad they're just going to get it out the door. I'm sad that it's going to be hard to use in the U.S. It's unfortunate. But hopefully this is the first step towards getting more open and free phone hardware that can run various different forms of free software. And all their software's been released, so if somebody ports it to another architecture, it'll be a good opportunity.
What was so difficult, do you know, about them trying to get approval by the FCC? Was it because
there's a lot of interesting FCC issues with regard to software-defined radios, and I encourage your listeners to take a look. We have a bunch of stuff on our website about this issue because we dealt with it for other issues related to wireless cards, but the same things come up with mobile phones. You have a higher burden to meet when you're the software on your radio, meaning anything that distributes waves over the air, is written in software as opposed to hard-coded into hardware. That's often a big challenge for getting things approved by the FCC. I just pasted the link in the channel there to our memo on the FCC rules about FOSS and software-defined radios. So I think there were some challenges there for them. They were also trying to find a vendor that would work with them. You know, a lot of the vendors are afraid of open source based platforms, so they had a hard time finding a vendor who wanted to work with them for the chip and various problems like that. It's been really tough. I mean I'm sad to see it work out this way, but a lot of us here weren't surprised. I held out hope for the longest of everybody here. You know, I was sort of, you know, saying we're going to use them at SFLC, they're going to be our phone, it's going to be great. And everybody here was very skeptical, basically because it's a hard thing to do, and it's a hard market to crack. I think what's going to happen likely is the folks at OpenMoko will have set the wave, and it's probably going to be somebody else that comes along and actually does a FOSS phone that works everywhere and does all the things that OpenMoko was supposed to promise. But you know, that they'll have the software from the OpenMoko development that they can start with, so that'll be good.
I mean, Google came out with this whole Android announcement. I mean, have you guys looked over what they're doing?
I am not familiar with that at all, actually, so I can't really
Basically, it's an API framework that's Java-like. That's not exactly Java, but the syntax is very much the same. And it's basically built on a Linux stack, but you can't... The only the only thing you can program the apps with is using their API. You can't code any native C or C++ programs on it. So it's a little limiting of what you can do with it. So, you know, they have a lot, you know, because they're, you know, it's Google, they have a lot of the bigger players involved with them. In fact, they're having a contest. $10 million they're looking to pay people to develop apps for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that now. You know, I'm looking for some of the news items.
Money talks, you know. You want to motivate people, yeah, you wait for block
cash. Well,
it looks
like they're trying to get their own spectrum for it. Is that part of the story, too? Some of the comments I'm reading seem to indicate that's part of it. Are they using the existing...
That's a possibility. Right. It's more just an API framework at this point.
Mm, right. Yeah, I mean it doesn't seem that different for me from what was already available on Motorola phones with Java applets and stuff that you could put onto them. So it really doesn't change all that much. I mean, I think the promise of OpenMoco was that it would actually be a platform that was as far down as they could go, was going to be open source and free software. And that's not something anybody else is going to try. That's why I was so impressed that they were even trying it, because it was a risky business thing for them to try. You know, it's really hard. I mean, that's the hardest place to put FOSS, where you have a supply chain of hardware that you have to build, and it has to work, and it has to work on networks that aren't under your control. I mean, the mobile phone industry is a very difficult industry to operate in. And then on the back end of it, they have to get. Because most people, at least in the United States, get their mobile phone and as part of a contract with their provider, they have to get it into the provider's hands. And I think they had a lot of challenges convincing providers that it was worth their while to offer this phone to customers, because it was very much a geek sort of device, and it was hard to get. On the other hand, if you look at things like the Sidekick, was only geeks got the Sidekick, and they used to fight over the fact that T-Mobile wouldn't give it to you, and then you had to buy it separately, and then you had to get it unlocked, and all this other stuff. And then eventually, the Sidekick became a device you could get from T-Mobile directly in the U.S. So I think we'll probably see that with these FOSS-based devices too over time. It's just gonna take time, like everything else does. You know, it took us 10 years to get GNOME good enough to beat Windows. You know, we'll have to take a lot of years to get this done.
Yeah, it's a dream, you know. It's something that sounds really cool, you know. And I think a lot of people would jump on board if it was became a reality. But it looks, I totally agree with you. It's going to take some time to get it done. You know, just the cell phone carriers in the United States alone, they're so resistant and it's so very closed. You know, you go and get a phone from a carrier, they disable half the features that the phone can do, you know.
So they can make you pay for them. Come on now.
Yeah.
Do you want me to answer this GPLv3 question, or do you want, or am I taking up too much time? I saw the computer.
No, you can do the GPL question.
You've taken up way too much time, Bradley. We need to. We don't like free software anyhow.
Well, I know you guys like to have your little.
No. By all means, answer that question, because if you don't answer the question, we got to hear from him all week about why. We didn't ask that question.
He's asking, one of the folks in the RC channel is asking about the various arguments against GPLv3. I think most of that came out of the whole Linux kernel process. And the first thing I want to point out is the real change in the Linux kernel thoughts and attitudes that happened during the v3 process. Around here at SFLC, we were calling it the GPLv2 perfection theory. You know, if you go back, you know, in time, like 4 years or so, and read some of the stuff that Linus was writing, he was saying things like, if I'd known about BSD when I started Linux, I would have just done that, and I wouldn't have used this GPL thing, and I wouldn't choose GPL again if I was given the choice. And the v3 process had this strange effect on a lot of people, but a lot of people who spent years and years and years criticizing GPLv2 have turned around and become big fans of GPLv2 but hate GPLv3. And I find this incredibly amusing. Now, from SFLC's perspective, we're fans of both licenses. You know, we have a large, people a lot of times associate us with FSF very closely, you know, because I came from there, because Evan Moglen used to be on the board of directors. But we're really a separate organization, and we have clients that use the GPL version 3, that use GPL version 2 or later, that use GPL version 2 only, that use the Apache license, that use the OpenSSL license, that use the various different BSD-like licenses, the ISC license, and so forth. So we're somewhat FOSS license agnostic at SFLC. We tend to recommend one of the copylefts to our clients, either LGPL, GPLv2, or GPLv3, if they're choosing a license, because we think they provide the best legal protection for copyright holders and for developers. But we're happy to accept clients from any of these places. So from our point of view, we don't get much into the arguments about V3 and like why people who are down on it and don't like it. I think it has a lot of advantages over V2 because it clarifies a number of different things. You know, I used to be a big fan of what Dan Ravisher once taught me to call the implicit patent grant in Section 7 of V2. But as I was saying earlier on the podcast here, that in fact, that thing is this Rorschach test of the GPL, because some people see that patent license in V2 as very, very narrow, and some people see it as very, very broad. And the great thing that V3 does, people complain about all these patent provisions and what they say and what they do, but in fact, I think if people really get down to the nitty-gritty of what those patent provisions do, they really make explicit what was generally believed to be true under V2 Section 7. People who study the license well, I think, realize that. There's also been a lot of complaints, and there was a lot of complaints from the Linux kernel community about the DRM clauses. And if you go and compare the first drafts of V3 with the later drafts, you'll find the DRM language was improved substantially, in part based on those complaints and the problems people had with those clauses in V3 as it was initially drafted. It was made better based on that, and I think what we call the consumer products system for when you have to worry about DRM issues is a great way to express it. It deals with the key issue for freedom when you get a consumer product is when the DRM clauses are in effect. And I think that works really, really well. And I think the complaints that we heard and the problems people had with it back during the process, I think if you go back and read now at the final draft that came out, you'll find a lot of those problems have been addressed. The other thing I want to talk about briefly is the Afero GPL. I have a funny feeling about GPLv3 because I was very involved early on before anybody heard about it back in 2002, 2003 when Evan Moglen and RMS and I were discussing V3. But I wasn't involved very directly in the later process during 2006 and 2005 and 2006. So one of the clauses that was really important to me that I actually designed in part, and some people say in whole, at least Evan's given me credit for it in whole, was the thing that's in Afero GPL, which is the network services issue. And I think that's a really important clause, and it's really important that we protect the issue of software as a service. When you use an AGPL program as a service, you have to provide the source code to everybody who receives services. And I think that's a really important clause. I had personally, just speaking for myself, had hoped that would be in GPLv3. It turns out, you know, they're doing it, they decided to do it in a separate license that is compatible with GPLv3. But I think that the fact that it's getting out there and it's supposed to be released pretty soon, I think is really good news. And I encourage people to take a look at Afero GPL because I think the software as a service issue is a really important issue for the future of software freedom, and I'd like to see more projects adopting the Afero GPL as their license, at least when they're designed to be used as software as a service.
That was a mouthful.
Yeah, I can rant and rave with the best of them.
So when do we expect GPL version 4?
I'm not really sure. It would be up to FSF to ask us to help. You know, I mean, one of the things that people, and this still is confusion, it's totally understandable because, like I was saying, you know, a number of us who were involved with FSF came over here to start SFLC. But, you know, we've taken the position that FSF is its own organization. They have their own suite of licenses. We like a number of their licenses and recommend to our clients, but it's really up to them when they want to do stuff next, you know. And if they want to do a GPLv4, we hope they'll give us a call. We'd love to help them with it. I think we really enjoy doing the V3 work. I think one of the amazing things about the V3 process was, you know, the the level to which we design the license in a community kind of way. You know, the software that I suppose I should hype a little bit, because I managed the project called STET, which was the software system used to collect comments on GPL. It was an Ajax application. I wasn't a really big fan of Ajax, so I couldn't bear to do it myself, but we hired somebody to do it. But that application was really neat. It allowed you to highlight a piece of text in the license, give comments on it. People could discuss via the commenting system about what they thought, and then Brett at FSF used those comments collected to feed into the process. And I think that was a really excellent thing. I was glad we developed that software and got community feedback. I think that the developing licenses in a community kind of way is a really important aspect of license development going forward. I certainly would love to see future versions of other licenses, you know, on other projects, be developed in a community way with a process that has committees to talk about the issues and has a public comment process that allows people to give input on the issues.
Wow.
What do you prefer then? I take it you are a GNOME guy, yes?
You know, I'm not a big GNOME user. The only thing from GNOME I actually run myself is the... I just run a panel, the GNOME panel at the top of the screen. And that's pretty much all I use from the GNOME. Strangely enough, for my window manager, I still, believe it or not, use Sawfish, even though it's totally unmaintained, primarily because I wrote a ton of Lisp code to do various things with my window manager a long, long time ago that I don't want to give up. And I haven't had the time to invest in figuring out how to make another window manager do the same thing that I could do in Lisp inside Sawfish. I'm an Emacs guy from way back, so using Lisp to configure my software is very, very comfortable for me. The reason I love GNOME, though, is because I think it's crossing the barrier to let people who aren't like uber geeks like me use open source and free software. I mean, that's why I think it's so important. That's why I'm such a big fan of it, because it's getting that job done. It's a job that I know nothing about. I am not a user of a graphical environment. I can't stand GUIs myself. They drive me nuts. I want to do everything inside Emacs or on the command line if I can't do it in Emacs. But I know that that's not how most people in the world use computers. And from my point of view, we've got to have stuff that works the way most people want it to work so that people will adopt open source and free software. So that's why I'm a fan of GNOME.
When are we going to see an Emacs soft phone?
Yeah, for soft phones, by the way, I use Twinkle. I should mention that. It's a project that doesn't get a lot of attention, but it's really, I think, the best soft phone out there. The guys have done amazing work for it. I'll put a URL on the channel shortly. But Twinkle is really neat. It is a GUI application, which annoys me, but you can talk to it and configure it from the command line, which is what I really need. You know, so you can place calls from the command line and various other things. And to answer your question in the channel there, I use Firefox, but I've been experimenting with this thing called, I forget what it's called, Conquer or whatever. It makes the browser look like Emacs, so I've been fooling with that and trying to get that working a little bit better. But I use W3M inside Emacs when I just want to look at a text page. If I get an email with a URL, I load it in Emacs first with W3M, and if I can't view it because it has graphics, I either go back and load it in the Firefox with a remote call. So yeah. I'm actually a big Astro. I know you guys are into Astros because that's how you're doing the podcast now and the live streaming stuff. I'm a big fan of Astros. It's an amazing project.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, I built our whole phone system here from the ground up with Asterisk, and at least internally it's all VoIP, and I got a provider to do DID termination to get back into the PSTN. It's one of the most important free software projects out there because it's taking back space that was totally proprietary. And if you look at the number of ROM installations around the country, you know, that are just so proprietary and so horrible. And then look at how Asterisk can replace all that stuff very easily and do an excellent job at it. It's really important software. I'm glad that Mark started it. It's excellent that he put all that work into it and made it happen.
Great piece of software, Asterisk. We love it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're straight to, I'm coming to you right through, I use the X connection into your server, so I'm coming straight to
you. You sound great. You sound nice and clear.
Yeah,
Yeah, and that's in part part from because of Eeks, in part because of Twinkle, man. Twinkle, maybe it needs a new name, as your IRC guy is suggesting, but I think it's a really an excellent soft phone. It does a great job.
That's Tinkle, right?
Yeah, see, this is why I'm glad I listened to your backlog, because I know you're not serious. I know you're not serious when you do that.
What was, you said Eeks?
Yeah, that's how the asterisk geeks pronounce it, Eeks, like E-E-K-S.
Oh. Oh.
I don't know. I always read it as IAX at first, and then I heard all the when I went to AstroCon, they all said Eeks. So, at least that's how Allison says it. Allison, the voice of asterisk, she says it that way.
Wait,
I met Allison. She was a celebrity at AstroCon. Do you know the default prompts in Asterisk? They're made by this woman named Allison, who's a Canadian voice actress, and she recorded a bunch of the prompts initially for Mark, and it's sort of become famous. People like take pictures with her at AstroCon and stuff. It's pretty funny. She's like a celebrity in the Asterisk world.
Yeah, I've heard of her.
Pretty funny.
Did you say does Twinkle does SIP, right? Not Eeks.
Yeah, it does SIP. So SIP. So I'm connected SIP into my Asterisk server here, and then from my Asterisk server to you, I'm going Eeks.
Okay.
So I tend to use SIP for local connections and Eeks for long haul connections, and I primarily do that because of the firewalling challenges with SIP. I tend to be pretty hardcore with blocking stuff and firewalls. And the thing I like about Eeks is it all can go across one UDP port. And you don't have to open up a ton of RTP ports like you do with SIP.
Right.
That sort of drives me nuts. A lot of people in the VoIP world, the non-asterisk people in the VoIP world, really, really hate Eeks. And I've never heard them really express why they feel that way. It's just sort of a personal bias, I think, because I've never gotten a good technical reason why Eeks is bad for long-haul transfers. I think SIP's better for local. Because you can send more stuff to it, so you can send things like message waiting, and we have voicemail waiting, and call waiting works better, and transfer works better, and so forth. But if you're just connecting to another server to send a VoIP, channel across, Eeks works really well, I've found.
Yeah, I'm in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania, which is about 100 miles west of New York City. Dan is down in Yorktown, Virginia, where the server's actually sitting.
Yep, so it's pretty good. I've got a lot of traffic shaping on my end that's sort of controlling. Plus, I'm the only one in the office, and we've got two T1s, so I'm primarily, other than the people who borrow our wireless network from the nearby Manhattan apartments, I'm the only one on the network.
So you let the nearby people graciously use your wireless network?
Oh yeah, I mean I don't really care. I did a lot of research into traffic shaping and stuff, so I've got it all well traffic shaped so that anything that's actual real office traffic gets super precedence over the over stuff coming from the wireless network. So I never have to worry about their using it. But I mean, I'm like, nobody's here on the weekends, nobody's here on the nights. Why not give these two T1s to whoever happens to be able to pick up our wireless network? Well, what do I care?
It's pretty cool of you.
Yeah, I just don't see the point. I mean, I guess there's a certain level of liability you get, but I mean, we have it open and we know it's open, and that's what we decided to do. So I asked. I mean, I work for a bunch of lawyers, right? So I asked everybody, can we do this? Is this okay? Does this give us open us up to anything? They're not fine. You can do it. So I just did it. So if they're not, if the lawyers I work with aren't worried, I'm not worried about a liability issue. So, I mean, it's open to anybody who just happens to be able to reach us. I look out my windows right now, and I see, probably hundreds of apartments. So there's lots of people around. It's actually a dual T1. It's a bonded T1 line. So it's a lot of bandwidth that we got sitting there. It doesn't do much. I mean, obviously, we run our own web server and stuff. So if we were getting slashed at it in the middle of all this, it would be kind of nasty. But we did okay.
You guys should probably host a mirror for us.
Yeah, I haven't gotten too much into that, mainly because while I have lots of bandwidth, I don't have a lot of hardware. I mean, we try to be economical with our hardware purchases. So my main Zen server, which has like so many things running on, it's kind of getting overloaded. The main server, my DMZ, which is basically hosting everything external facing, is kind of overloaded. So I have bandwidth. I have a good amount of bandwidth, but I don't have a lot of hardware. We got a pretty good deal. Speakeasy is our ISP. We got a pretty good deal on the T1 lines. It was a 2-year contract thing.
On the other hand, the downside is that Speakeasy was bought by Best Buy recently, and I'm really kind of worried about the future of Speakeasy as a good ISP. They were always this really awesome ISP. They didn't care if you ran servers. They didn't do throttling, all this sort of stuff. They were really sort of community-focused ISP, but now that Best Buy owns them, I guess it won't be so nice, but I'm just waiting for the shoe to drop on that one.
Yeah, I ran, when I was up in Pennsylvania, I ran Speakeasy, and they were great, but they didn't have the service down here where I moved to. So I had to get business class cable.
Oh, it's so expensive for so little. It's unbelievable. That's the only way you can get a static IP from the cable company. It's horrible.
Right.
Yeah, it's, and they block, and the cable company is block port 80. You know, I mean, I tell people, you know, I'm actually kind of snobbish about this in a way. But when people tell me, like, oh, they have a cable access, I'm like, you don't have the internet. The internet's a peer-to-peer medium. You know, it's designed for people to be equals on the network. And what the cable companies and a lot of the ISPs have done is they've turned it into television, basically. It's like you can't run your own web server. You can't run your own mail server. It's, you're not a member of the internet. You're not on the internet if you can't be a node on the internet.
Oh, you can.
That's the whole point.
I have a cable connection. I just run my web server on 8080.
Yeah, but that's why should you have to do that? You should be allowed to run it on the same. And I think people, when they see 8080 in the URL, they wonder, like, is this legitimate, you know? Because they don't see it that often. I've known, not somebody like us, but people who are not that familiar with the web, they see something weird in that URL bar, and they're like, does that mean this is like, am I getting fished? You know, they get scared.
Nigerian scam.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So.
Pat's made a lot of money from his Nigerian scams.
Yes, I have.
Speaking of Nigerian scams, I should paste in the channel that slide from my OF talk you guys saw. And that might amuse your IRC viewers. Let's see if I can find it here. Do you guys remember that slide? Did you guys were at OF?
Yes, I would remember it if I saw it.
Okay, well, I'm going to... We'll keep talking here. I'll try to find it. It's got on my heart.
While you're doing that, Bradley, I just wanted to bring up something with Dan. Apparently, BinRes is calling it quits after 200 episodes.
Yep.
And I'm pretty bummed out about it. They did a fantastic job the last 4 years. They're one of our main live streaming servers. And Stank Dog has decided to call it a day. They had a special 7-hour, 200 episode. Have you listened to it, Dan?
Not yet. I don't even have it.
I listened to it yesterday. And it was kind of sad, you know? Ben Rev has been there a long time.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer, but they do a great job, and congratulations to their run. And I look forward to listening to all 7 hours.
Yeah, it's cool, you know. You know, props to those guys. Stank Dog and the crew, you know. Best of luck to you. If you guys ever want to come on to our show and hang out and talk tech or whatever, you know, the door's always open for you guys. Please shoot us an email, and we'll set it up.
Yes, I found that slide and pasted it into the channel there.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, I pulled that off Slashdot. It was some guy wrote it up when I had a Slashdot comment during the SCO thing. I always thought of Daryl McBride as sort of a scammer, you know, trying to convince people to give him a bunch of money for something he didn't actually have. So it turns out it was pretty much the case. It was exactly as that thing described. So I have a question for you guys. I'm curious. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. How do you guys feel yourself, you know, fitting into the whole Linux podcast world? I just noticed there's so many of them that have cropped up recently. I've been sort of trying to subscribe to them all and hear what they're all like. But I'm curious what you guys think about the whole Linux podcast space. I think it's a great medium. You know, it's very community oriented in the way that I think is good for our community, but I'm just curious what you think about all the
we hate them all.
Ones, which ones you think are good, and so forth. Oh, yeah.
They're all bastards.
Why, because you guys did it first? Is that the story? Or?
No, we never did it first. The Linux show was the first real live show.
We did it second.
Yeah, we did it second.
We sucked first, though. That's no, I think...
But at least we sucked and did it for practically nothing.
Yes, I really enjoyed. That's pretty much all I listen to is primarily the Linux and FOSS-based podcasts. There's a few others I sprinkle in there, but I pretty much listen to all of them, and I try to maintain a list of all the Linux sites on my website and provide links and everything. And we're going to be expanding.
Yeah, that's actually that. I found out a bunch of new ones I didn't know about was from your page there.
Yeah, and on the chat IRC right now, Dave Yates is on there, and he does a lot of Linux Links podcasts, which is phenomenal. If you haven't listened to that, definitely listen to that. And Chess Griffin with his Linux Reality, very, very, very good stuff. There's more cropping up. Like every couple of months, another one shows up, which is really good. One or two.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, when I used to get exercise, I used to walk for exercise, and I'm trying to start doing that again, and it's, having lots of good stuff is really great. And I just think it's a medium that's particularly good for our community, I was saying before, stuff about concision and really talking through issues, I think it's a great opportunity. I mean, that's, like I keep talking about your Bill Hurd show, I never hear an interview with him anywhere. That would give that much information in a normal, traditional medium. First of all, nobody would bother to go back and talk to a guy from Commodore from so long ago. And second, they wouldn't give him enough time even if they did. And I think the whole idea of the podcast medium is really great for communities. My wife is into various other, fandoms. I think she's really into she's a Harry Potter fan. And the Harry Potter podcasts have been a really excellent way for that community to sort of build their fandom up. I'm a poker player, and I listen to a number of poker podcasts. It's the same thing there, and I think our community can really benefit from the medium. And I think it's great that you guys are doing it. It's good that you guys give your time every week to sit on here and then talk through this whatever's going on in the open source and free software world.
We at least try to do something every week. That's our goal, And yeah. I think we've hit that since starting the show and. We'll just keep on doing it, We're like a virus that just keeps enveloping everything, slowly.
You can't kill it.
Yeah, and we do try to maintain a good relationship with the other shows. And I think we do for the most part.
Yeah, and we always promote.
Yeah, I listen to the whole Lug Radio Linux Action Show like Turf War or whatever that is going on is kind of silly. I think. I hope it's all in good fun. When I hear them sort of go after each other, I hope it's all in good fun.
I'm pretty sure it is.
That's
good.
Is.
That's good. Yeah.
But those pictures on the Lug Radio website are gay.
I'm not a fan of that insult, I've heard you guys talk about those pictures, and I've heard other people talk about those pictures. Should I load them now? I have not actually looked at these things. So you can actually get somebody's first reaction to them.
Yeah, that's what it is. But Jono's been in bands, I've been in bands, in 30 years.
We're talking about the Lug Radio pictures, not some of those other
pictures. Yeah, the Lug
pictures.
Radio pictures. Okay. Yeah, Radio pictures.
So the one with Jono giving the finger and the other guys, is that the one you're talking about, or is there others?
Yeah, that's a little pretentious.
I like their pictures. Yeah. I think it's great.
I think it's kind of cheesy.
More power to them.
That's what, they get off on, hey, more power to you.
They just don't like you, Pat. That's why you're angry.
I've done that. I'm not angry. I like their show. I like all the shows, And, I've been in bands, over the years, and, I've done those pictures, and you look back at them, you got to laugh at them, It's so silly. The whole, I'm flipping the bird to the camera, I'm mean, I'm a badass. It's kind of funny,
Yeah.
To each his own.
Yeah, the picture does not, that main picture there does not really express their personalities. I mean, and it's, the whole thing is kind of like hyper serious, and they're more of, I don't know if it's good promo for them, because they're more of sort of a goofing around fun kind of team, and they come across as like, we're going to give you serious information about Linux and other technologies.
We're going to kick your ass.
Yeah, maybe a little of that too, I don't know.
we hope to one day join the Twit network. That is our main goal.
Alan listens religiously to Mac Break Weekly.
No, actually I don't.
Shut up, Alan. You've talked enough already.
I don't think I've ever heard that, actually.
Yeah,
they like the bash Linux on that show as much as they can. No, I like Leo Laporte. It would be actually, I actually interviewed him, God, I don't know how many years ago, 3 years ago. And he comes off as a pretty nice guy, but I'm not crazy about the shows they produce on that whole network thing.
Yeah, you bogarted that whole interview with him, too, and didn't let anybody else contribute.
Well, nobody else wanted to participate.
I don't remember that.
You didn't even know who he was.
It's funny, I downloaded the whole backlog of Chris's Floss Weekly show or whatever it is. I haven't listened to any of them yet.
12 episodes?
I have not experienced it and seen what it's like yet.
We like Chris, but Floss Quarterly, it needs to come out a little more often.
Yeah, I noticed that I subscribed to it, and now, you know, I thought my little Perl script that downloads podcasts was broken because it hadn't gotten anything new from that one. And I was like, oh, no, it's fine. They just haven't done anything.
I don't think he's doing it anymore.
Yeah. Well, Chris has always been the kind of guy, he easily gets overcommitted. You know, he's been like, I've known him since like 1999. He's always been like that. Always tries to do more than he really has time for because he's excited about it, and he kind of has to cut bait every once in a while. So it's probably one of those things for him. I think a lot of us are like that in the Foss world. We tend to take on more than we can chew. You know, I've got my little pet project that I've been trying to start for 2 years now that I haven't started. So that's yet another. Everybody's got their things they never get back to.
Everybody's busy.
Yeah, I can tell you about that pet project if you still have time. If you're curious.
What are you doing?
So I barely started yet. But okay, so you know I'm a big fan of Emacs, right? And if you guys look at my master's thesis work, I was working on porting Perl to the Java Virtual Machine, which I realized was a really bad idea after giving it a try. But for reasons you might not expect on first look. But my goal was to make a universal virtual machine, or find a universal virtual machine that could run all the different dynamic languages, Perl, Python, PHP, Ruby, so forth, and all run on the same framework so that when you have an object in Perl and you want to call it and instantiate it from Python, you should be able to do that with no trouble. The virtual machine should take care of all that work for you. So that's what I was working on my master's thesis, and it stemmed out of that well, I got the job for FSF right away almost after graduating, so I never got to take that idea any further, but the guys in the Perl community started the Parrot project, which actually is doing that same sort of thing, and they sort of took the stuff I saw in my thesis and said, well, you know, I obviously was clear the JVM was not the right virtual machine, so they decided to write their own. And Parrot's come along really, really well, and it's getting really good. And a number of different, I think Python's already been ported to it, and Perl 6 is going to run on it, and Perl 5 is going to run on it eventually, and so forth. And PHP, I think, runs on it already. And so my plan was to take Emacs. And one of the reasons a lot of people hate Emacs is because they hate Emacs Lisp. They don't like writing in Lisp. Well, we should have an Emacs that has Parrot Engine in it, so you can write that Emacs file in any language you want, Perl, Python, Ruby, whatever. So that's the idea of what I want to do. I've looked at it a number of times and have never started, but at some point, my spare time, which I don't have enough of, I want to get that started. So. And most people who don't use Emacs and don't like Parrot think it's crazy. But everybody I talk to who either uses Emacs or is into Parrot all think it's a great idea. So at least I'll have fans in two communities, if nowhere else. Wow, I got pure silence in response.
You killed the conversation.
Well, yeah, you talked about Emacs Lisp that has a way of doing that.
Yeah, we're more VI guys ourselves.
But wouldn't you like to script VI in Ruby or Python or Perl or PHP?
Sure, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, see? So this is the idea. It doesn't have to be an Emacs thing. It could be VI as well.
Alan's a notepad kind of guy.
Nah, he's at the Mac.
Crimson Editor.
I just use whatever happens to be in front of me, actually, most of the time.
I got a good Mac story for you. I've been checking out some of these prices on these laptops, and I've been pricing out the comparable Linux-based 1420 Dell system. I also looked at the Lenovo ThinkPad. And just for shits and giggles, I took a look at the Apple Store. And for the same Dell 1420 laptop that comes preloaded with Ubuntu for about $1,000,
something comparable on Apple, for instance, the MacBook 13-inch, it was about $1,700. And then the MacBook Pro was about $2,200. And the ThinkPad was about, $1,300 or so? Yeah, about $1,300, give or take, a little less, 12 and change. So all those people that say that Apple laptops are comparably priced to other machines, they're lying.
Yeah, but you're paying for quality and innovation.
I know. You're paying for that pretty-looking case, I guess.
But I still like mine, so.
Alan, you're free to buy that if you want. That's what it's all about.
And Bradley likes his MacBook.
I'm a ThinkPad guy, and we've always used ThinkPads here at SVLC. And I'm actually getting really worried with the. I think Lenovo is not taking the line in a really good direction. And you know, one of the great things about the ThinkPad was you could buy them used off eBay. They were a little more pricey, but you got warranty left from IBM, and the IBM warranty service is just was just excellent. And it sort of went downhill since Lenovo has taken over completely. And I'm sort of worried that there's not going to be that high-end sort of excellent service laptop on the marketplace anymore. You know, from a point of view of like, 'cause, you know, I mean, I do lots of things here at SFLC, but I'm also responsible for the internal technology. So I want laptop hardware that I don't have to think about. I can give to the users. You know, the tech guy can call in, the tech support guy here can call in, to get a box sent, send it away, get taken care of. It doesn't require any real attention from anybody here because the service from the vendor is so good. But I don't know of any other company that offers that kind of service. Even Lenovo isn't anymore. So I'm getting pretty worried about the end of the ThinkPad as we know it because of the way Lenovo's been since they bought it out.
Now, when you buy your ThinkPads, you must get them. How do you get them? What comes with them?
I search eBay for anything that has genuine IBM warranty left on it, basically, or these days genuine Lenovo warranty left on it, and I just buy whatever they got, pretty much. What are you asking specifically, I guess?
Oh, so you're not buying them, like, brand new?
No, I never have. You know, it's sort of like buying a car brand new. You know, it's like you drive it off the lot and it loses, you know, what, a tenth of its value immediately? You know, I think the IBM ThinkPads are that way. And the nice thing about buying them on eBay with warranty left is the warranty is fully transferable. So as the new owner, you have full rights to extend the warranty if you want to or... And get warranty service and so forth. So you're sort of letting the other people eat the initial cost of how expensive they are brand new, and then you get them on eBay and are able to keep the warranty and even extend it if you want to pay to keep the laptops under warranty. So I think it's excellent. Now, I noticed that the nice 3-year warranty you used to get with every IBM ThinkPad now, Lenovo does not sell that by default. They say that it's a 1-year warranty by default, which sort of kills that secondhand market because most people won't pay for the warranty upgrade on the new buy, which means that when they find their way into the secondhand market, they won't have any warranty left, which really, I'm already starting to miss the golden age of eBay ThinkPads when you could buy. I got some laptops when I first started buying for SFLC back in the beginning of 2005. They have warranties that just expired a few months ago. This is stuff I bought off eBay for like $600, $700, $800. It was really excellent, but those days are quickly disappearing. And I think the quality's gone down. I think that Lenovo is not trying to make the industrial strength laptop that IBM used to make. I was really sad about that, the Lenovo sell. Plus, I've heard stories. I've not confirmed any of them. The Slashdot stories about where Lenovos are built and that it might not be not be the best labor practices or whatever. I have no
same shitty factories that the Apples are made in.
Probably, yeah. It's probably pretty hard to buy a laptop product that's made in a factory that treats its workers well. It's probably generally difficult.
Ah, well.
Well, I think most of the hardware is made in those same crappy factories.
Yeah, exactly. It's the downside of globalization.
Yep.
So, what is the Software Freedom Foundation? Screw that name up. What do you guys do for computers at the office? I mean, you just buy and used?
The laptops I've generally always bought used. I'm obviously, as I was just saying, probably going to have to start thinking of a new policy eventually on that. Pretty much everybody uses a laptop. It's just much more convenient for people to work. People, you know, if they have to work remotely, all sorts of things, you know, that it's just easier for everybody to have a laptop. So everybody here has a laptop as their primary computer. I have a set of servers. I have an Asterisk server. All our servers are actually named after Supreme Court judges. Brandeis is our Asterisk server. Douglas is sort of our main SVN server, as well as like intranet, wiki, and pretty much anything that's going to run as a service for everybody runs on there. Then I have Wisdom, there was actually a judge named Winston. They're not all Supreme Court justices. Some of them are just district court judges as well. Wisdom is my main box, Zenbox, and my DMZ that does all the external facing stuff, the website, the IMAP server, that sort of thing. That's pretty much, and Murphy, which is our backup, which is kind of cool that there was a judge named Murphy and I named the backup server Murphy. So that's pretty much our infrastructure here. We have 9 employees, so it's not a huge office. So that works pretty well for all of us. Pretty much everybody here is either very technically minded already. You know, a lot of the legal staff we've hired have been people who were, you know, sort of geeks before they went to law school. And the ones who aren't have sort of become that way. You know, Dan Ravisher was not really a computer geek when he first got involved. He actually used to do stuff for FSF back in the day. But I gave him a box back in those days, a laptop running Debian at the time and stuff. And he's sort of become assimilated. He's learned how to do a few things on the command line. He does love his GUIs. He loves anything that's a GUI application. But he's become pretty technically minded, you know, just out of interest in the FOSS world and so forth. So we're not a typical law office by any means. I mean, you won't find any law office other than us running SVN as our primary document repository, for example. I've done some work trying to get some of the software we developed internally out there. I really was hoping that at some point I'd get some more time in my schedule to really, you know, sort of explain and put out there what, you know, the technology we're using internally, even if it's just tutorials on how I sort of integrated and hooked everything together. And I do want to do more of that as time goes on. It's just, you know, with a big small shop and I'm doing lots of, you know, sort of non-technical work like the GPL enforcement stuff and various other things that I don't get as much time as I'd like to do it. But one of our sort of secondary goals, as you can read about on our website, is to put technology out there that helps an office run. I've always believed that I've been in the FOSS nonprofit world since basically 1998 now, taking my volunteer days into account. And I've always believed in the eat your own dog food philosophy. You know, at FSF it was a hard and fast rule from RMS that we run only open source and free software. But when we started SFLC, you know, the only compromise I made was wireless device drivers, mainly because of the FCC issues, are the primary reason they're proprietary anyway. But that's pretty much the only proprietary software that we've used. Actually, that is the only proprietary software we use on a regular basis at SFLC. Because I think, you know, for supporting the FOSS community, we should be using their stuff. And there's no question about that in my mind. So I don't really consider any technologies that aren't open source and free software.
Well, it's getting late, fellas. I think we're going to wrap it up. Bradley, thanks for coming on the show.
I love it. If you want to have any of our other, if you like, I know you had a lot of patent questions that I sort of didn't
absolutely
glossed over.
Absolutely.
I'm sure Richard will be happy to come on the show and talk about some of those issues. So I'll follow up an email after tomorrow sometime, and we'll see what you want to do for getting maybe some other people from SFLC on to talk to you.
That would be great. We really appreciate it.
Oh, definitely, Bradley. We appreciate you coming on. It's been phenomenal.
Yeah, I was glad to do it. So I love these podcasts. I think they're a great part of the community. I'm glad you guys are doing it, and I'll still be listening.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot, great. Bradley.
Thanks, guys.
Have a good night. Bye. And we're going to wrap it up. Alan, you got anything else to add besides
usual
Mac stuff?
Shut your mouth, Alan. Oh.
I'm done. It's late. I got to get up at 4:30, and I know I got a long day tomorrow. So,
Dan, you got anything else besides BinRev?
No, that's it. That's it. Should I play us out?
Yeah, what the hell?
I hope Link's back next week. Hope he feels better.
Hope so.
Thank you all for listening. We had an obvious lack of hate mail the past couple of weeks. We enjoy getting all your mail. Send us your email. That's techshow@thelinuxlink.net. Questions, comments, anything. We enjoy it. Links, pictures. We love your email. Please keep sending them in. We love your hate mail, too. If you want to hate on us, go right ahead. We'll talk to you guys next. Talk at you guys. Oh, crap. What are we doing about next week?
One of us is going to have to stream this show.
All right.
I'll give it a shot if you'd like. I downloaded the latest Anabolic. I'll see if I can connect. Is the server information the same, Dan?
Yeah. I'll resend you all the information.
Yeah, let me resend me the info.
I'll
give it a shot.
Okay. So we'll talk to you guys next week. Have a happy holiday.
Happy Thanksgiving, Dan.
Same to you. I'll try and call in next week or something, but I'm going to be at the Outer Banks, so I don't know. All right, have a happy, and this is Dancing on My Grave by John Zeilman from PodSafe Audio. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Ah! I wonder why it plays it out of order. I have shuffle on.
What is this show? What number is this show?
I don't know. I don't know. Let me check.
Good night.
When I listen to you talking, I can hear it in your voice. There's no doubt in your everyone believes you, you'd leave them no choice. To be cruel is to be kind. Should have listened to the warning, whose turn it is to cry. Everybody's leaving, not a chance to say goodbye.
Dancing.
So we can paint anything we want?
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.